Okay, if I could have your attention. I'm calling to order this November 16th? Mm-hmm. Yeah, November 16th, 2015, meeting of the Senate Workforce and General Government Committee. Welcome everyone here. We have a full house in this room, and we have an overflow room in Hearing Room D. So if any of you are watching and want to come in the flesh, go over to D, at least for now. We have a piece of committee business that we have to do, first of all, and that is to adopt our interim committee rules. Normally, we would have done it in September, but we didn't meet in September, and so we will do it today. So could I have someone make a motion to approve, adopt the interim committee rules?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce and General Government proposed committee rules.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum has moved adoption of the interim committee rules. Any discussion? These are the templates that template rules that all the committees are following, I believe. Mm-hmm. Is that right, Jan?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions, comments? Is there any objection to our adopting the rules? Okay. So ordered. They are adopted. Okay. I am going now to open an informational meeting on unemployment insurance benefits when participating in apprenticeship training. How's that for a title? Anyway, as you'll see, it's a very important issue. And one that we are likely to be looking at in the February session. So I'd like to call up Kate Newhall and Steve Sims, who can introduce this, what the problem is here, and we'll look at potential solutions. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today on behalf of the Sheet Metal Contractors Association, or SMACNA, and SMART Local 16, which are the Sheet Metal Workers Union, to talk about an issue related to apprenticeship and unemployment insurance. SMACNA and Sheet Metal 16 have a long history of working together on issues that are in the best interest of their industry and their workforce. For example, they've worked over the last couple sessions on CTE revitalization and bringing shop classes back to middle and high schools, primarily because they were recognizing with the decline of those programs that workers weren't showing up ready to be successful in their apprenticeship programs. They were missing some of the basic skills like math or even how to read a tape measure. It's through a joint partnership that the sheet metal contractors and the union train their future workforce. The sheet metal apprenticeship program is administered and paid for jointly by the contractors and the union, and all of their training is done without a dime of taxpayer support. They spend roughly $1 million per year on the Sheet Metal Institute and doing training through this partnership. The Sheet Metal Training Institute has two state-of-the-art campuses in Oregon. We've got one in Portland and one in Springfield. And for the sheet metal program, they do what's called consolidated training. Apprentices actually come off the job to do their associated classroom instruction each year. Some apprenticeship programs do their related training in nights or evening classes. Some programs do it like the sheet metal workers do in consolidated blocks of time. So for the sheet metal apprenticeship program, it's a five-year program that the apprentices participate in. And for two of those 5 years, the apprentices are required to do 6 weeks of classroom training. For 3 years of their apprenticeship program, they only do 5 weeks of training. And while the sheet metal apprentices are in the classroom for their training, it's a full-time endeavor. They're in school for 40 hours a week to receive this classroom instruction. Fortunately, when apprentices are off the job, they're able to claim unemployment insurance. But the unfortunate part is that they're limited to 5 weeks of unemployment insurance when they come off the job. If apprentices are actually laid off the job, they're eligible for the full 26 weeks of unemployment insurance. So for two full years of their apprenticeship program, they are limited to this 5 weeks of unemployment insurance, but they have 6 full weeks of training. And I guess I would say it's more like 4 weeks of unemployment insurance benefit because they're still subject to the waiting week that happens that first week of an unemployment insurance claim, which they don't get any benefits for. And I would say just because an apprentice is not working because they're in school, doesn't mean that their bills stop. Many, they still have their rent, they still have their bills to pay, many have families to support, so it really is a financial hardship for these apprentices. And, you know, even when they do get unemployment insurance, it's only a fraction of what they make when they're actually out on the job working. And what I would also say is that for these apprentices, they can't actually return to their jobs or advance in their program if they don't do this associated training. So they can't advance if they don't complete this every year. So now just a little bit about why do apprentices in the sheet metal industry have more than 5 weeks of training. And I guess I would say the answer is twofold. I think the training and the industry has gotten more technical and more advanced over the last years. Unfortunately, they're also having to do more remedial training for apprentices that are starting in the program. Much like why they've invested in advocating for CTE work, they have to spend a lot of their time in apprenticeship programs just teaching the apprentices some basic math skills. So what you have in OLIS under my testimony is some proposed language for a solution to this and actually a second problem that apprentices who do consolidated training face. The second problem I'll just explain really quickly. It seemed to me as I was doing the research for this bill that if we could solve two problems with a one-word change, we should go ahead and do that. So because unemployment insurance benefits are based on your benefit year, and the benefit year starts the very first day a claim is made, if an apprenticeship program decides from year to move the dates of its training, so in a hypothetical, for example, if an apprenticeship program started its training on March 1st of year one, but then in year two decided for whatever reason to move that training backwards in time and start on February 1st, that apprentice would technically have 2 years of their training that fall within the same benefit year. And so for that second year's training, they would not actually be eligible for unemployment insurance. So that is the reason in the proposed language that we have proposed moving the 5 week limitation to 10 weeks so that we can give all of the programs out there that do consolidated training a little bit more flexibility in changing their dates. It might be because spring break is a different week, 1 week, or Thanksgiving is a little bit later, so that they don't have to risk their apprentices' unemployment insurance benefits if they're changing the dates. So I guess the last thing I would say is we have been working, even though the agencies are technically neutral on any proposal, we have been working with both BOLI and the Employment Department to get a good assessment on what this impact is going to cost. It's going to, I think, be very, very minimal. And also what other crafts are potentially impacted by this. So we do know that the sheet metal apprentices or the sheet metal program is the only program that does currently more than 5 weeks of training, and they only have those 2 years where they do 6 weeks of training. So I appreciate the ability to work with the agencies to sort of find what the best, simplest solution to this problem is, and look forward to working on this issue in 2016.
Okay, happy to answer questions. Thanks, Kate. Let's hear from Steve first, and then we can open it up to questions.
Thank you, Senator Dembro, committee member. Steve Sims, S-I-M-M-S. I am the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I think Ms. Newhall stated the situation accurately. The real issue from our standpoint is we see that these private apprenticeship programs that for the most part pay for the cost of related instruction, and they're looking for strategies to make sure that when they do this block training and these apprentices are off of work, they cannot earn income, we want to make sure that they can continue that training. This goes beyond the sheet metal program, but to a number of our programs. I think we've come up with about 7 or 8 programs that do consolidated block training. And as Kate stated, sometimes they just have more than 5 weeks of training at a time. In other cases, scheduling that training may create a situation where more than 5 weeks of training is needed within a calendar year. By expanding the limitation on apprentices being able to collect unemployment benefits when they are out of work simply because they are participating in mandatory training, I think that's another great way to promote the use of the apprenticeship model of training. It helps the employers who support these programs facilitate their long-term goals of training. We do not believe, and it's difficult to get an exact figure on the number of apprentices who would benefit from this from year to year. because the total number of registrations change from year to year, scheduling changes from year to year. But based upon our discussions with the Employment Department, we do not think that there'll be a substantial cost associated were the limitation be taken from five weeks to 10 weeks. Be happy to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Questions, members? I do have one. So it seems to me that the model of consolidated training, where people can come from different parts of the state to the central training location, is going to make it easier for people, for apprentices in the more rural parts of the state, to accommodate both their training and their work. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's one of the many reasons why some programs have gone to block training. They bring all of their apprentices together for a fixed period of time. Other apprentices, not in the same class, will fill in the work on the job site, but they can have that whole class together for 5, 6, 7 weeks, and they get their training at once. It also helps these schools, which, as Ms. Newhall stated, are paid for but with private funds, helps them organize their and schedule their training more efficiently. So the program sponsors can probably give you a half a dozen other reasons why it's more efficient for them to train in this fashion, but it's something that's been going on in the industry since 1996, and we see it ebb and flow as training strategies change, but there are a number of benefits for the industry.
Okay, great. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Both of you. All right, our next panel, we have Dave Gerstenfeld and Jason Barbie to help us see the world through the eyes of the Employment Department.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Division Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. I'm actually here in case there are some more general questions about how this interplays with the rest of the unemployment insurance system, and I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Barbie, who worked closely with the drafters of this concept, to explain in more detail.
Yeah. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Barbie with the Oregon Employment Department. I work in the Unemployment Insurance Division in the policy area. Before I get started, I do want to thank Kate Newhall and Steve Sims for engaging the department early in this concept. While we see this as a policy decision and will remain neutral, we appreciate the opportunity to provide input. So just a recap, there's a ton of eligibility requirements that have to be met in order to receive unemployment benefits. Three of them are: you must be available for work, you must be actively seeking work, and then you must accept suitable work if offered to you. ORS 657-357 allows an exception to those three requirements if you're in an approved apprenticeship program. And as you've heard, currently it's limited to 5 weeks. This concept would increase that from 5 weeks to 10 weeks. I just had a few thoughts here that you might be interested in. One of them is conformity. As you likely know, Oregon is required to be in conformity with the Department of Labor laws, and if we're not, we can lose our administrative grant to administer the UI program, unemployment insurance program, and employers could lose their federal unemployment tax credit. We don't see this as being an issue with conformity, although the U.S. Department of Labor makes that final determination. Now, you might be interested in the impact to the employers, because there will be an impact, because employers that have individuals that file for benefits, those employers get charged to their account for that. We don't see it as being a big impact, because if we're talking about 1 or 2 weeks a year, and you're talking about a maximum benefit amount of $567 a week, that there really isn't too much of an impact to what the tax rate will be, which takes into consideration the amount of charges on that employer's account. The impact to the trust fund is probably another question that you guys have, as Kate alluded to. We don't see it as being a huge impact to the trust fund for the next biennium. Based on the information that we have, we're thinking it's probably going to be less than a $40,000 impact for the next biennium. And with the trust fund currently standing at $2.7 billion, right around there, not a huge impact. I do want to make it clear, though, that the impact that we're talking about is just for this biennium based on the known information. Because there's a lot of flexibility in what apprenticeship programs can do, should a number of apprenticeship programs take greater advantage of this exception, there could end up being a larger impact to the trust fund and also to our ability to, the employment department's ability to administer that. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions, colleagues? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Thank you. And I'm not sure if you were the ones to answer it, but just throwing it out there. It looks like the sheet metal folks, if I'm reading this right, have about 6 weeks of training. Do I get nods? Okay.
That's
fine. Are there training apprenticeship programs out there that have a longer training period than 6 weeks, or is that about the maximum?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, from my understanding is there is only one apprenticeship program, and that is the sheet metal workers. That is over 5 weeks at this time. So the 6 weeks, from my understanding, is the longest.
Okay. And I guess my follow-up question was, why go from 5 to 10? Why not just a 6?
Follow-up on that is that's just a policy decision. From a little bit of history, apparently this has been changed two times previously. It went from 0 to 3 weeks, 3 to 5. And so I think the idea is looking forward, do we want to come back and if things change? But that's a policy decision on what's best. I think Kate did talk about the potential of changing the training timing. So if you have somebody that has training in March, say 5 weeks training in March, the next year it starts in February, because that hasn't been a full benefit year, the apprentices wouldn't receive the benefits
Thank
for
you.
That week.
I think the idea is just to give it more flexibility, but you know, that's of course something we can talk about when the time comes. You're probably the right person to ask, but I just saw something about the employer rates going down for employment insurance. Can you tell us about that, since we have you here as captive?
Sure. Actually, I will defer to David on that.
Chair Dembro, thank you for that question. Again, for the record, David Gerstenfeld with the Employment Department, and we did just announce that the employer tax rates for unemployment insurance will be decreasing in 2016. We determine those rates annually based on a statutory formula, and it's essentially looking at the health of the unemployment insurance trust fund. So as that fund is better able to withstand a severe economic pressure like a recession, then the employer tax rates tend to go down. When the fund is depleted and there's a need to replenish that safety net, then the tax rates go up. The system in Oregon self-balances through a statutory formula, which has worked very well. So actually, we are moving in 2016 to Tax Schedule 4, which is our equilibrium schedule. So that essentially means that the trust fund has recovered from the stresses of the Great Recession. So the average tax rate for employers will be dropping in 2016.
Great. One piece of good news. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you both.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our final panel, we have Brian Parson and Gordon Harvey, please. And I don't know how you want to do it, if we want to hear it from the apprentices' perspective first, or the contractors, or...
What do you think, Brian?
It was fine with me. I can give you some insight if you want me to go first.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right.
We appreciate your coming.
Yeah, thanks. Chair Dembro and committee, I'd like to just kind of give you
some
Brian,
insight. Could you just give us your first and last name for the record?
Brian Parsons.
Thank you.
And I'm I've been in this trade for about 8 years now. Getting towards the latter end of my apprenticeship, and I've personally experienced what they're talking about, and what you've touched on, it can be very tough. I mean, I've been with the same company for about 7, almost 8 years, and in that time I've gone from entry level walking in the door to buying my first house, and you know, so it's a great thing when you choose to stick with it and put your mind to it, but there is, you know, it's a commitment, and it's a commitment whether it's easy or whether it's hard. And I've been one of those people where I believe what happened to me, I mean, it's been a year or two back, but if I remember right, the biggest issue for me was, like you said, bills don't go away just because you're not working. And in order to further progress, this training is very important. And what happened is essentially as soon as you claim, your claim year starts, and the school year runs off a completely different timetable. So I've had an experience before where, say, I'd be finishing the tail end of one of my years of apprenticeship, and boom, my claim runs out. So not only have I claimed maybe 2 to 3 weeks for that school year, but then I have to start a new claim and have a waiting week. And then also, if, say, that would have been the sixth week of claiming for school, that's 2 weeks that I don't get paid. And there have been instances where I've had school potentially 3-4 months in a row. You know, they have to give you a minimum of a month between classes, but it can be very trying. And when you're unable to get that benefit, it's very stressful, because that the benefit, granted, is awesome. It's a fantastic thing. It helps out. But once you progress to a couple years into the trade, that benefit is maybe slightly over 50, 60% of your wage. And then on top of that, we do pay for school out of our own pocket. It is funded, but we pay because we're accredited. So essentially that benefit, if you choose to have taxes taken out, which I do for the state, after you pay for school, you have about maybe $250 for the week. And that's, you know, people with families, people with mortgages, it's completely out of our control is the other part that makes it very difficult. So potentially getting that flexibility, as you've said, would be huge, especially for, there's a lot of young families, a lot of people, you know, we're working full time a lot of the time anyways, and then to go and have to do training and then, you know, make 75% of your wage for that month, it can be very tough.
All right, great. We'll come back to you, Brian.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and members of the Senate Workforce Committee. My name is Gordon Harvey. I'm a 29-year member of SMART Local 16, and I currently sit on the Local 16 JTC and JTC Trust. I'm the detailing and fabrication manager for TCM Corporation, who you probably know better as Temp Control Mechanical. Been in business in the Portland area for about 61 years. We have over 250 employees. Of that 250, about 120 are sheet metal workers, and 23 of those are currently apprentices. TCM's also a member of SMART, who Kate mentioned, who represent over 60 sheet metal contractors in Oregon. I'm here to testify on behalf of both TCM and SMACNA in support of this bill concept. As SMACNA has been working on this issue with our labor partners at SMART Local 16 for some time now. We appreciate Chair Dembrough's sponsorship of the bill and support of our efforts in this problem. As an active member of the JTC, I take my duty to the industry to attract and retain the most qualified and engaged apprentice applicants very seriously. As a committee, the JTC makes the expectations of an apprentice very clear to the applicants and make certain that they understand the high level of commitment they assume if accepted into the program. We also make sure they understand the opportunities that Local 16 offers will be both personally and financially rewarding, but can only be achieved through commitment and hard work. Excuse me. As a manager within the TCM organization, I take our company's responsibility to each apprentice very seriously. To provide an environment conducive to learning and actively ensure our obligation to provide meaningful on-the-job training. All this requires a significant investment in time and resources, and what we ask of the apprentice in return is just effort and engagement, both on the job and in the classroom. A majority of the funding is provided through employer contributions to the apprenticeship, and training is provided at no cost to the taxpayer. However, foregoing an entire 2 weeks of pay, one for the waiting week and one for the 6 week of unemployment, can create a financial hardship on an individual who's just trying to follow the rules and provide a better life for them and their family. It's my sincere belief that the proposed amendments to ORS 657.357 will have an unequivocal positive impact by creating a more engaged and highly skilled construction workforce that will directly benefit the longer-term economic health of our communities. At TCM, we have 12 published and highly visible core values. The second of those is do the right thing. In my opinion, this is the right thing to do. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Gordon. Any questions for either gentleman? Just want to say that, Kate mentioned the interest that the legislature's had in CTE, And, you know, I think that has been a great phenomenon over the last few years. But I would say, I think I'm speaking for this committee as a whole, and, you know, that we're also really committed to the apprenticeship model and to create better connections between CTE and then into apprenticeship and into a life of productive work. And this training model just seems to make so much sense. You know, the combination of on the job, in the class, and so to make it more viable, I think is really a good thing. So really appreciate your coming forward and giving us your personal voices for this.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'll close that informational hearing on unemployment and apprenticeship. And I will open our informational hearing on efforts to raise Oregon's minimum wage, which will take us through the remainder of the meeting. So, colleagues, you'll remember that our committee, together with the House Business and Labor Committee, met jointly last spring in a lengthy public hearing on the subject of minimum wage. We heard some very compelling testimony, I think, from a number of workers and also from small businesses, people from all over the state. And the testimony raised a number of questions about just who low-wage workers are, what their needs are, and what economists say about the impact that a rise in the minimum wage could have on employment. So, you know, we knew that we had to dig deeper into these questions, and immediately upon, or actually just before the end of the 2015 session, Representative Holvey and I convened a group, invited a fairly broad array of people to be part of the process of digging into these questions. And then many others came forward who wanted to be part of the process. So we had people from a number of different areas. We had advocates for increasing the wage. We had the state's major and some minor business associations, including small business, agriculture, restaurant industry, human services, nonprofits, BOLI and other state agencies, and then legislators from both parties were there. We had four meetings, and over the course of those four meetings, we covered a number of topics, and these are those that come to mind, and Jan can correct me or flesh it out. We had a thorough presentation on who the minimum wage workers in Oregon are. We got that from mainly from the Employment Department, from Graham Slater and his associates, who they are in Oregon and across the U.S. We looked at what it means to be self-sufficient, to be able to provide for your family without government support or public or private support, and how that standard of what it means to be self-sufficient varies around the state. We looked at the variety of factors that keep families from being self-sufficient, along with low wages, of course, those things that keep them in poverty, including the high cost of housing, childcare, and a lack of technical training that can get them higher wage jobs. We looked at the challenge of the benefits cliff, that, you know, if people earn so much that they no longer qualify for public benefits, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? We looked at that, and we heard from people from DHS about that. We looked at the potential revenue that could come in as a result of the higher income taxes that will be paid by Oregonians who would be earning higher wages, along with the results of the escalator effect of more wages being spent in local businesses and that economic activity leading to higher state taxes. And what do we do with that money? How could we use that money perhaps to mitigate potential harm. And finally, we looked at the various new minimum wage laws and initiatives that are underway in various cities and states, and how those policies are how those entities have crafted policies with different wage levels or different phase-in timelines based on a number of factors, in an effort to try to do the most good for the most people while having the least risk of harm. So my hope is to use today's hearing as a way to close the circle on those discussions, on that research, and to begin to move us forward towards a legislative solution. We know that there are initiatives out there that are destined for the November 2016 ballot, and we'll be hearing from representatives of those two campaigns. But I've heard a lot of desire from people on all sides of the issue for the legislature to try to come up with a legislative solution to this problem in February, if we can. And, you know, to come up with something that's more nuanced, more workable, something that people could get together around and that would eliminate the need for us to go to the ballot. So that's really the reason for today's hearing. A week from tomorrow, I think, is our deadline for submitting bill requests from our legislative council. And I do intend to submit a request having to do with the minimum wage. And so, you know, I want us to have a last chance to hear from people in the trenches to give us some ideas about what ought to be in such legislation. So, with that, we have a number of panels, I'd like to start with the first panel, which is just the experience of low wages and poverty in Oregon. And I want to call up Gladys Hernandez and Reverend Mark Knutson, please. And as they're coming up, we have a shift in panels. The next up was going to be the City of Portland, City Club of Portland was going to give a report on their recent report. But for logistical reasons, we have to flip that with the next panel. So panel three will be coming up next. Okay. Welcome, both of you. Thank you for coming to Salem.
Thank you. Thanks.
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, my name is Gladys Hernandez, and I work for Hanley at the Portland Airport. Okay. I worked there for pushing chair for 8 years and continue to make the minimum wage. My only raises have come from the annual inflation adjustment that the state makes. As many of you know, this year there won't be any adjustment to the minimum wage. And while 25 cents per hour may not sound like much to you, I have come to rely on those small increases just to survive. Without this raise, my difficult financial situation will get even worse. The only way my husband and I even get close to paying for the bare necessities is by renting out a room in our house to a stranger. Without that extra income, we will be on the street ourselves. My husband recently lost his job. With a single minimum income and no benefits, we simply can't afford the basics in life. The mortgage always gets paid late, meaning those late fees and the interest on them keeps tracking up. We can afford even the most basic of health plan, meaning we can afford to go to the doctor or have any kind of preventive care. I'm supposed to have an annual screening breast cancer, but I haven't had one in the last 5 years. Going to have one would mean we won't be able to pay the electric bill for a month, and we will go without. So I choose to keep my stove running, the lights on, and the heat above freezing, instead of having the necessary care to catch a potentially life-threatening situation. These are the kinds of decisions I and thousands of others like me have to make on the daily basis. I would love to have health insurance. I would like to know that I can catch something before it becomes too serious. And even if I did, there would be options to help me cover it. But the way things are now, we cannot afford insurance. We cannot afford to go to the doctor. We cannot afford to save even $1. I pushed wheelchair for Southwest Airlines, a company that made $1.1 billion a year last year. And I want to know, where is the money going? My coworkers and I, we're not greedy. We know business is about making a profit. But what about those people who made the company successful? Shouldn't we share in that success? They could do better for us. Portland's airport was just ranked the number one airport in the country for the third year in a row. Who makes that possible? Shouldn't we receive some of that credit and be thanked for our hard work? They could do better for us also. My husband and I, and thousands of other Oregonians like us, struggle every day affording even the most basic needs. Shouldn't we rest easy that we can afford a simple cancer screening without losing the ability to heat our house? You, senators, every one of you, can do better for us. And I love my job. I take pride in the work that I do. I'm proud to have helped make PDS the best airport in the nation. But if I could find another job, I would. The truth is, I'm not young anymore. You can see me. Yeah. And I don't have the same skill that the technology in a younger person seems to be born with. A child 2 years now, they can look for the computer. I can. It's hard for me. A $4 to $5 per hour increase in my wages would be life-changing. I would mean peace of mind. It would mean not having to prioritize between health care and the mortgage. I am not asking for much. I'm just asking to be able to continue to do my work, the work I love, while getting fairly paid for it, so I can have a standard of living that would actually be considered living. Because right now, I feel like I am barely surviving. And that's all I have to tell you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hernandez. Let's hear from the Reverend, and then maybe we'll have questions.
Thank you.
Senator Dembrow, members of the committee, thank you for having this hearing today and the opportunity to testify. My name is Reverend Mark Knutson. I've been senior pastor at Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland for the last 20 years. We are a thriving multicultural, multinational congregation called to seek justice and peace. And to give ourselves away for the community, I want to underscore the voice you just heard of Mrs. Hernandez are the voices that should be most listened to in this state, in this conversation, because that's where the answer lies. And you are the ones called to implement, so it's always good to testify before you. Augustana is also not only a congregation of justice seekers and peacemakers. You can imagine 900 people behind me who would be here today if they didn't have to be at work or school or other places supporting this. And I'm just one of a large number of people of faith who are here today and have been here in the past, testifying on behalf of sisters and brothers who deserve a living wage in this state. We are also home to 6 nonprofits, Community Alliance of Tenants, the Families in Action, Interfaith Movement for Worker Justice, Well Arts Institute, Society of Haitian Arts, Culture, and Social Support, and the Irvington Preschool. So with 30,000 visits made a year just to our corner of Portland, we hear story after story after story of the impact of low wages in this state and what that means. Across our state, we are facing a moral and economic challenge, plain and simple. Thousands of Oregonians are working hard and still earning so little that it's a struggle just to put food on the table and care for their families, not only in terms of food, but housing, school, health care, child care, the list goes on. Minimum wage workers in this state are a cross-section of our community. It's all of us. They're the folks who care for the elderly and keeping our buildings clean, working at the airports, the people harvesting the food we eat. They're our neighbors, our relatives, our friends, members of our synagogues, our churches, our temples, our mosques, and other places of worship. And there are people who put in a full day at jobs and yet they're left having to choose between rent or buying groceries or a minimum wage. And let's be real. $9.35 an hour means if you work 52 weeks times 40 hours, you'll take home $19,240. Housing in Portland minimally runs $14,000 to $15,000 a year right now. You know the statistics coming out of Portland. If we raise it to $13.50, which as a person of faith I say is still not a living wage, you'd be taking home $28,080. So as you look at this legislation, do not forget the other things in this state that help families to make it. Let's not make this a win-lose battle in terms of the support families need until we get the wage to what it truly needs to be. While it's a myth that minimum wage workers are many times teenagers, they are most often women in their 30s with children. And this affects our elders, our youth, immigrants, persons of color, and that's unjust. There's a lot of talk about equity, inclusion, and diversity, but we have to make our laws match up to what we say. And this is one that must be changed. As a society, we believe it's our moral obligation to answer and ensure opportunity for every human being. In my tradition, we talk about abundant life. We live in an abundant state. We all know that. It's the economies we create and the laws we create and you as lawmakers that we put our trust in to do justice for those who are most vulnerable, because that is how we measure the success of a state. It's not measured on how the well-off are doing. It's measured on how the most vulnerable in our midst are doing. I look at you, I know you, and I know you understand that well. We are here today, Muslim, Jew, Hindu, Buddhist, Native American spiritual leaders, Christians, and so many good people to say it's time we raise the wages. We know the income disparities in this country, and we know one step we can take right now is to raise the minimum wage. I hope you will lead the way on it. We are here today because we believe everyone's work is important. Everyone is valued. We are here today because of shared values and shared purposes from our many traditions. We are here today because we believe in the inherent value and dignity of work and of the sacredness of every human being, and family values mean families are able to make it, as well as singles and elders. We believe workers deserve to be paid a decent wage, recognizing the value of the work they do. We are here today because we believe our faith demands it. We are here today because the role of faith communities, the ones I've just mentioned and others, is to be a conscience in our society and to raise up the ethical and moral dimensions of life together in this state, and to remind public servants and elected leaders like you that we have a moral obligation to care for the common good for the people of Oregon. We judge our state by how others are doing. Let me just say in closing, as a faith leader, in Scripture, God gets the most angry when the widow, the orphan, the immigrant, the vulnerable are forgotten or trampled upon. It's not about sexual mores. It's about economic and social justice. If you take the Bible, which contains the Hebrew Scriptures and the New Testament, you can cross out all the things dealing with economic and social justice, and you end up with a little bitty Bible in comparison. So as people of faith, we have no choice, and as human beings, no choice but to be here today and to strongly urge you to move quickly and rapidly to raise the minimum wage, and then to look at the whole picture going forward, that families and individuals in the state, all people who reside here, can have life, have it abundantly and with great dignity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank you both for kicking off this hearing and setting the framework for the need to raise the minimum wage in Oregon. And just a couple of very brief comments. To you, Reverend Knudsen, thank you for being here. It's good to see you again. It's particularly appropriate that you start off the testimony because, as you may know, it was a nun named Sister Miriam Teresa who in Oregon in 1912 got the first minimum wage law for women passed in the entire nation. She wasn't a nun at the time. She was a social worker named Carolyn Gleason, but she did become a nun and the head of the sociology department at Merrillhurst College.
Yes.
And that was her work. And Gladys, it is wonderful to see you here because you illustrate something that I think about all the time, which is the job you do at the airport. I've experienced trying to get your coworkers to help when I'm traveling with my dad, who's 93 and can't get around the airport. And I think people often assume that your job pays more than minimum wage, but of course it doesn't. And the struggle that you're experiencing and those choices are exactly what so many people, whether they're taking care of our kids or elderly parents, are struggling with. So thank you so much for the work that you do. We can do better and we will do better for you, and I'm committed to make that happen.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I have to head back to Portland. I'm chairing the Northwest Health Foundation board, and our focus these 5 years is healthy beginnings, healthy communities. And we know that can't help happen without families who have living wage jobs, as you all know. So thank you for championing this legislation.
Thank you. You may say you had no choice but to come, but we really appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you both.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
To get going. So do you want to bring her up next?
Yeah. We'll bring the panel up.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll hold them there and then now.
Yeah. Okay. Our next panel, we have Andrea Miller and Justin Norton Kurtzen, and then on the phone we'll have Laura Fieser.
Laura,
hi. This is Senator Michael Dembro. You are now live with the Senate Workforce Committee, and we're really looking forward to your testimony. But we're actually going to start. We'll start with Andrea and Justin, because Andrea's got to head out.
Okay, so that sounds great, and thank you so much for inviting me.
No, we really appreciate it. So. Audience, we have representatives from the two ballot measures that are on the headed to the ballot, and we also have Laura. Is it Huizar?
Yes, that's right.
Who's with the National Employment Law Project? So we'll get a state perspective, and then we'll get a more national perspective. And so, Andrea, why don't you tell us about the Raise the Wage proposal?
Thank you, Senator, and thank you, members of the committee, and for accommodating my schedule. I have to run to Bend, your district, Senator Knope, after this. So thank you for the opportunity to support increasing the minimum wage. As you know, I'm Andrea Miller, the executive director of CAUSA. We're an immigrant rights organization, and we are on the Raise the Wage Coalition. And as you've heard from us from so many times, yes, we're preparing to go to the ballot, but ultimately we want to have a detailed conversation with the legislature and see if we can get this passed in the February session. It is important to us to be able to have that detailed conversation because, you know, one fact is indisputable that today's minimum wage is not something that people can live on. We heard that from Gladys, and we heard that from the Reverend. And right now, As the Reverend said, working full time is just $19,240 a year, and that's really not enough to pay the basics like housing, food, and trips to the doctor, for example. And we aren't talking about folks that are just starting out their careers or entry level positions. And I think, you know, a lot of our focus has been, and a lot of the reason why we're doing this work is looking at who is actually impacted. And I know we've had a lot of conversation about who it is, but I think it bears repeating. The average minimum wage worker is a 35-year-old woman, many of whom are the primary or co-breadwinners in their family. And demographically speaking, women and people of color are overrepresented in low-wage work. In Oregon, nearly two-thirds of low-wage workers are women, whereas women are about 50% of our state's population. And according to the American Community Survey, 20% of low-wage workers are people of color. Looking more specifically, half of all Black or African-American workers, and 45% of Latinos are employed in the low-wage worker sectors. And these are folks struggling to get by to support themselves and their families despite working full-time. And I wanted to highlight two more stories. I think it's just so important to continue to think about the actual people impacted by this. One is the story of Casille Capriel, who works at the airport as well, just like Gladys. She's a mother of three, and she earns a minimum wage. And she's worked at the Portland Airport for 8 years. And every day, she puts forward her full effort in her job, but there is really no path towards getting a raise or any type of benefits that reflect the breadth and experience that she brings at the airport. And as is the case for many Oregonians working to take care of their families, working full-time, going back to school or switching careers is a much longer-term trajectory. It's not a short-term solution. So the other story I have is a single person. So, yeah, you've heard a lot about families impacted by this, but it's not really much easier for single adults either. Jason, for example, is a fast food worker. He lives in Eugene, and he's worked at the same restaurant for 6 years. He was recently promoted to entry-level manager, which only got him a 40-cent per hour raise, just bringing him under $10 an hour. And even after cutting everything from his budget, like going to the movies, eating out, he still struggles to make ends meet. There are just some things that you can't cut from a budget, like paying your rent, paying, you know, debt payments, cost of transportation. And, you know, when you are still trying to cover those bills, it also means that you're not saving for emergencies. So, for example, Jason's wallet was stolen, and it took him several months to replace his license because he couldn't afford immediately the $60 it takes to replace a license. And as you know, he couldn't apply for new jobs without that type of ID or do anything else that requires identification. So those are two really important stories to highlight. As Oregonians, as Raise the Wage, as Causa, we believe in the dignity of work. And we believe that when you work full time, you should be able to be self-sufficient and not have to rely on public assistance benefits. But the reality is, the way the rules are now, hundreds of thousands of Oregonians are working very hard every day, but they still have to rely on public assistance, costing taxpayers $1.7 billion in public assistance benefits. That's a lot of money for taxpayers to be buying, and we believe that businesses should be taking on some of that. So we believe we must change this picture. As you've heard many times, more than 500,000 Oregonians will benefit if the state wage floor were to be increased to $13.50 an hour, which is the lowest wage necessary to provide a basic standard of living, even in Oregon's most rural counties. But we also know that $13.50 is not enough, as many people have said, which is why we also want to restore power to local communities like Portland, Eugene, for example, so that they can establish a higher wage. We certainly realize that living in Portland is not the same as living in Enterprise, Oregon, in terms of your cost of living. And ultimately, you know, I believe we need to ask ourselves, are we invested in making an Oregon that where families can be self-sufficient? Or will we insist upon maintaining an unsustainable status quo where taxpayers are paying a lot in public benefits? So ultimately, we believe that raising the minimum wage is right. We know that workers and a majority of voters are with us, and we ask that you consider and take this up in the short session. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Let's hear from Justin, and then we'll release you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Chair Dumbro, members of the committee, my name is Justin Norton Kurtzen. I'm with 15 Now Oregon. So we're back here again, right? We did this last April. We all came and talked about the minimum wage, what we think should be done with the minimum wage, and we didn't get anything out of it. And we all know that that is not an issue of Republicans versus Democrats, right? Democrats hold the majority in both houses, hold the governor's seat. And while there are certainly some really strong leaders on the minimum wage among Democrats, ultimately the issue is among Democrats, right? Democrats who understand and Democrats who are holding back and aren't ready to do the right thing. So we're sort of left wondering what the point of this is. You know, why should we believe that this session is going to be any different? It's only a month long. The issue is not any less complicated than it was last year. And you know, if we were to get anything out of this 2016 session, if we were to get a minimum wage increase, well, what would it look like, and what would the compromise be? Would it be high enough for places like Portland or Ashland or Corvallis or Eugene? Would we leave farm workers out? Would we get a tip credit? So while we sincerely hope that we're wrong, we're pretty skeptical that anything effective on the statewide minimum wage is going to come out of the short session, which is why back in April, before the last session was even over, a number of organizations filed the 15 ballot measure. That group's now the Oregonians for 15 Coalition. That ballot measure would raise the wage to $15 per hour over 3 years. $11.50 in 2017, $13.25 in 2018, and then $15 in 2019, and index it back to inflation. Phase-in would be the same for all businesses and employers, no matter what size, and there are no new exemptions or exceptions to who gets paid the minimum wage. And I think just to sort of give an idea, right, I mean, over 50 unions, community groups, faith groups, and small businesses have already endorsed the ballot measure. In the first month of having our ballot title and collecting signatures, an all-volunteer force of low-wage workers and concerned people collected over 10,000 signatures already. So this is well on its way to the ballot. And I think if just to sort of get a sense of where support lies, not only in this room, but really throughout the state, I think if you support a statewide $15 minimum wage, could you stand up for me really quickly, just for a second? Great. So I think that makes a pretty clear statement, right? I mean, people are willing to come from all over the state to be here to support 15. And when you get out in the streets and you start talking to people, it's no different. People are really excited about this. People know that it's what is needed. And it's not just in Portland or in Eugene or in the urban areas that a $15 minimum wage is so important. 15 really is the right number for the whole state, even rural Oregon. Right? The Alliance for a Just Society just put out their new job gap study just about a month ago that shows that a single individual with no dependents anywhere in the state of Oregon needs to earn at least $15.99 per hour in order to be able to afford the basics, save a little bit for emergencies, and stay off public assistance. MIT's living wage calculator shows that a single parent anywhere in the state of Oregon needs to earn at least $21 per hour in order to take care of their family. And again, we're not just talking about Portland. We're talking about the entire state of Oregon. And don't forget, too, that public assistance for working people in the state costs taxpayers over $1.7 billion per year, right? That's billions of dollars per year that could be going towards education, vocational programs, shoring up social services for those who can't work, or really anything other than corporate welfare and subsidizing poverty wages. So we hear from both Republicans and Democrats that 15 is too high for the whole state. It'll hurt rural Oregon. But after decades of good jobs disappearing from rural Oregon, good-paying jobs are exactly what are needed. Where am I? Right, it's exactly what's needed in order to increase spending in those rural economies. It's exactly what's needed to jumpstart their lagging economies. No one ever says that good jobs are bad for the economy, right? They're good for the economy, unless we're talking about low-wage workers. Then all of a sudden, the sky's going to fall. The idea that rural Oregon economies can't take a $15 minimum wage or a high minimum wage of any kind really isn't based on fact. This is based on speculation of hypothetical situations, mostly by people who don't really even support raising the minimum wage, or at least not a significant raise in the minimum wage. But we do have evidence, real numbers, on past similarly large statewide minimum wage increases right here in Oregon, right? From 1989 to 1991, the statewide minimum wage increased by 42%. Oregon Center for Public Policy put out a great piece on this. An average of 21% per year that the minimum wage increased in those 2 years, right? And the economy did great in the 1990s. We had a strong economy for the next decade, right? Small businesses did not perish and disappear, right? Entrepreneurs did not flee the state. We did well. Well, if we jumped from 925 to 15, that would be a 62% increase, and we're talking about over 3 years. That's less than 21% per year, right? It's actually a smaller increase year over year than what happened here in Oregon in 89 and 90. So the fact is that 15 is not only the right number, it's what working people need, and it's an increase that actual facts about real minimum wage increases right here in Oregon show that our economy is not only capable of handling, but capable of thriving under. But, and we agree with Andrea and the Raise the Wage folks that while 15 is the right number for the whole state, even rural Oregon, we know that it's even more expensive in places like Portland and other urban areas, which is why we agree that the anti-worker, ALEC-inspired minimum wage preemption law needs to be repealed and local control of the minimum wage needs to be restored. We need 15 and preemption repeal in order for this state to move forward and have a strong economy and keep people out of poverty. And if you won't pass 15 or repeal preemption, then we would hope the least that you could do and what we would ask you to do is refer these pieces to the ballot, refer 15 to the ballot, refer preemption repeal to the ballot so that the people, the voters, can go on in November 2016 and actually make the decision for themselves and do the right thing for themselves. Thank you.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Where are more workers' voices?
Where are more workers' voices?
Workers.
We are the voices of Oregon's 700,000 low-wage workers.
We all know that $15 per hour.
We all know that $15 per hour
is the bare minimum.
Is the bare minimum.
Working families in Oregon need more.
Working families in Oregon need more.
To house their families.
To house their families.
To feed their children.
To feed their children.
To afford.
To afford.
Just the bare necessities.
Just the bare necessities. Without relying on public assistance.
That's why Oregon needs 15 now.
That's why Oregon needs 15 now.
We all know that.
We all know that.
$15 per hour.
$15 per hour.
Isn't enough in many places.
Isn't enough in many places.
Like Eugene.
Like Eugene.
Like Hood River.
Like Hood River.
Like Ashland.
Like Ashland.
Like the Portland area.
Like the Portland area.
That's why we need to restore.
That's why we need to restore. Local control of minimum wage.
15 now and local control.
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 Because black lives matter.
Because black lives matter.
For home care workers.
For home care workers.
For child care workers.
15 now.
For janitors.
15 now.
For single mothers.
15 now.
For food service workers.
15 now.
For security guards.
15 now.
Let's move on. Laura, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Can I go ahead?
Yeah, why don't you? Thank you.
We have her
thank
testimony.
Thank you again
before.
For inviting me to okay. testify today. My name is Laura Rivar, and I'm a staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, or NELP. And NELP is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and advocacy organization specializing in employment policy. We're based in New York, but we have offices across the country, and our staff are recognized as policy experts in areas such as unemployment insurance, wage and hour enforcement, and, as is relevant for today, the minimum wage. And so I would like to testify today in support of enacting a statewide minimum wage increase in Oregon. And I will add a bit to the testimony that you've heard today on the impact of raising the state's minimum wage, and also how such an action would fit into the national landscape. I can also address the economic research on the benefits of raising the minimum wage and respond to opponents' arguments about the benefits cliff possibilities. And ultimately, NELP would also like to encourage this committee and the legislature to give cities and counties the power to enact a local minimum wage. We have submitted detailed written testimony, and I'd be happy to answer questions to it at the end, if that is all right.
That's great. Thank you very much, Laura.
So to begin, I can offer, as I mentioned, a bit more detail about the type of impact that an increase to the minimum wage would have on workers. And based on data that's been gathered by the Economic Policy Institute and the Oregon Center for Public Policy, we know that an increase to $13.50 an hour by 2019 would directly affect about 457,000 workers in Oregon. An increase to $15 by 2018, on the other hand, would directly impact close to 600,000 workers in the state. So these are potentially large impacts that we're talking about. As others have mentioned as well, a $13.50 or a 15-hour minimum wage would give workers in the state a much more realistic chance of attaining a basic standard of living. Across the state, a worker with no children needs approximately $30,000 a year to get by, and a single worker with just one child would need approximately $50,000 to make ends meet. And so a statewide increase could potentially have a significant effect on those families. In addition, a $13.50 or $15 statewide minimum wage would positively impact women and people of color. And across the country, these groups, women and people of color, make up a disproportionate number of low-wage workers. Nationally, Oregon is not alone. Workers are facing a wage crisis and expanding income inequality, and one of the most important things we can do is address these problems through raising the minimum wage. Just between 2009 and 2014, averaged across all occupations, the real median hourly wages declined by 4%, and that decline was even steeper for low-wage occupations. So it's not surprising for us to see that, to date, almost 30 cities and counties have enacted a higher local minimum wage, and that includes Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, and others. Almost 20 states have enacted statewide minimum wage increases, and those include Vermont, Connecticut, Alaska, Minnesota, and others. But we're also seeing more and more cities and states at this point ask for or enact laws to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We've so far seen cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, SeaTac, and Emeryville, California, increase the minimum wage to $15. And the states that are now considering a $15 legislative proposal or ballot initiative include New York, California, Washington, D.C., and Missouri, in addition to Oregon. And of course, we're seeing that there is increased or growing popular support for these measures. And polling data tells us that approximately 2 out of 3 individuals now support a $15 minimum wage, and support is even higher amongst low-wage workers. With regards to the benefits that can come from raising the minimum wage, the research tells us that increasing the minimum wage can have a very direct and very significant impact on the lives of workers and their families. Over the past decade, for example, San Francisco's minimum wage has raised pay by more than $1.2 billion for more than 55,000 workers, and that has permanently raised the citywide pay rate to the bottom 10% of the San Francisco workforce. And while some opponents will argue that raising the minimum wage will result in job losses, we now have about 20 years of very rigorous economic research that tells us that increasing workers' wages through the minimum wage will come or can happen without reducing employment. In fact, the most sophisticated study to date that's compared employment patterns in more than 250 cities and counties in the U.S. that had different minimum wage rates. These are neighboring cities or counties. The study concluded that there was no difference in job growth rates in those places. And we're seeing more and more rigorous economic research on the city level or the city level minimum wage laws that have passed. And that research also supports the conclusion that one can increase the minimum wage without leading to any discernible impact on job growth. With regards to opponents' benefits cliff argument, this is sometimes used, as I think you've mentioned, to argue that increasing the minimum wage will lead low-wage workers to lose their public benefits in a way that will cancel out the wage gains. But these claims are highly exaggerated. And a report by the Oregon Center for Public Policy recently explained in much more detail that higher wages do make families more economically secure and self-sufficient. Most public benefits in Oregon help families by gradually declining the benefit amount as income increases. And this is with the rationale that wage gains will leave families better off. So for example, the earned income tax credit will phase out as income increases. And for a single parent with at least one child, the earned income tax credit does not phase out completely until the parent's annual gross adjusted income exceeds $39,131. The Oregon Center for Public Policy did find that the state program for subsidized child care does not always phase out the way that it should, and that for some families, the income gains could be canceled out by increasing costs to participate in the program. However, in those cases where public benefits do not phase out gradually, the solution is not to forego a much-needed increase to the state minimum wage. The solution is to fix those programs' phase-out rules, and those need to be fixed regardless of whether there's an increase in the minimum wage. Finally, we would like to, in addition to voicing support for increasing the state's minimum wage, we would like to urge you and the state legislature to give cities and counties the power to enact a local minimum wage. Most of the jobs, as others have mentioned, pay less than $13.50 or $15 in the state of Oregon. Many of those low-wage jobs are located in urban areas where workers do need more than $13.50 to make ends meet and to support their families. And so as we detail in our written testimony, all of the real-world recent data that we've looked at and the economic research we have tells us that increasing the minimum wage can lead to wage gains and benefits for workers without hurting employment or job growth. And so ultimately, by increasing the state's minimum wage while allowing localities to enact their own local minimum wages, Oregon can ensure significant economic gains for hundreds of thousands of workers while recognizing that some of its workers will require a higher wage in order to attain the same economic security as their neighbors. And so I would like to thank you again for inviting me to testify, and I am happy to try to answer your questions.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.
Colleagues, questions? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, first I was trying to figure out what study that was that you referred to on page 7 of your, I think, is what you distributed to the committee members from the National Employment Law Project. I think this is your testimony anyway.
It talks
about the most rigorous research.
And by the way, this
is
available on OLIS for you.
I'm just trying to figure out what that study was.
Right. So we did include a number of different studies in that report. The study I mentioned in my testimony just now is a 2010 study by Dubay and Arden, I can't pronounce his first name, Arden
Dubay. Is that footnote 21? Is that footnote 21? Okay.
With the University of California, Massachusetts, and North Carolina. It was published in the Review of Economics and Statistics. And that 2010 study is considered one of the most sophisticated studies on the effects of raising the minimum wage. They were essentially able to isolate the effect of raising the minimum wage. I focused on counties and cities that were neighboring or next to each other but had different wage rates.
Okay, thank you. I think that's footnote 21. If you look at that name, it is very hard to pronounce.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's footnote 21, footnote 28 as well.
Okay.
And there are a couple of other studies in our report that essentially back up that 2010 study. We have at this point, like I mentioned, about 20 years of very rigorous economic research finding the same, reaching the same conclusion that one can increase the minimum wage without necessarily leading to job losses.
Well, then I do have a follow-up question to that. If that's the case, why, and maybe you're not aware of this, maybe this would have been a better question for the previous panel, but they left, has to do with the step-up from what it is currently to another increase next year and then another increase to an eventual increase of $15 an hour. Why the step up? Why not just go to it?
Sorry. I think I lost a little bit of the connection. Can you hear me still?
Yeah, we hear you.
I think
I understood the question to be, why would there be different phase-in periods for a lot of these minimum wage laws if the research tells us that there is no discernible impact on job losses?
Right.
Right, and I think the research, of course, is looking at all kinds of minimum wage levels. They're not necessarily looking at, $15 or $13.50, and the jump that we're considering, that you're considering in Oregon, or that other places have considered. And so we work with economists and other advocates who think very carefully about what kind of phase-in will allow businesses and employers to adjust, and so in that way to definitely make sure that they have time to deal with any extra costs or impact on the business, and so those phase-ins are carefully thought through in order to make sure that that we get the benefits from the minimum wage increases without the losses.
Okay, thank you. It just seems to me like it's an acknowledgement, perhaps, that there is a negative impact, perhaps, on the economy.
Well, I think that the studies have not... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Laura.
Yes, I think the studies have, looked at different wage rates across the country for years, and so there may not be a study that looks precisely at the type of increase that you're considering in Oregon, but the research generally does support the conclusion that one can increase the minimum wage without significant job losses. And so each case may be different as one implements the law, but generally the economic research supports that conclusion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just want to add, too, then, we do regularly increase the minimum wage here in Oregon. We have the second highest minimum wage in the United States right now, which would seem to comport with having a lower poverty rate, and we don't have that, so I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting discussion.
Yeah. Well, we know that there are a lot of factors involved in poverty, but the wage is the wage, and, I think that, presumably if people are paid at a level where they're above the poverty level, then they'll be above the poverty level.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to debate this, obviously. We'll have plenty of time to talk about this, but I would just point out that recently at Portland State University, there was a forum on raising the minimum wage, and Tom Petowski, who I believe is the chair now of the economics department at Portland State, but he is the former state economist, so I think Senator Thatcher might remember him from our time in the House together when he was the state economist, but he basically talked about the studies and pretty much came to the conclusion that the reputable economic studies have not shown a job loss related to
increases in the minimum wage, such as are being proposed now. And but it's no doubt true that there are dueling studies, but I think, you know, you obviously have to look at the facts, but I think the consensus of economists, and these are not radical, wild-eyed economists, are that the predictions of job loss that have been made have not come true. And there, you can look at evidence in the past. You can look at the last time the Oregon legislature raised the minimum wage. That was in 1989. I see Ellen Lowe in the audience, who led that effort to get that law passed here in Oregon. That was approximately a 60% increase in the minimum wage in three steps. And the kind of predictions of job loss that we hear today in Oregon, we heard back then. And we found, and a state economist verified, that they did not come to pass. And so I just wanted to put that on the record and thank the witness for her testimony, too.
Thank you. Laura, so, you know, as you say, there have been, you know, studies over the last 20 years or so. We've been looking at the impacts of the rise in the minimum wage. And there are a number of states that have that have the ability for local governments to raise their wage to a higher level than the state minimum wage. But I don't think we have a lot of experience with that, do we? I mean, recently we've seen, you know, several jurisdictions take that step. But do we have some experience to look at as to how a local wage higher than a state wage has worked?
Well, I think that states, as you mentioned, have had, or states have given localities in many places the power to enact those local minimum wage rates. And we have seen places like Baltimore, as early as the 1960s, enact a local minimum wage. Mm. I think there's at least one other city that very early on, I think early on, also approved their own local wage rate. But San Francisco, I think, is a great example. At this point, because they first increased their minimum wage in 2003. So we now have over 10 years of experience from San Francisco's minimum wage efforts and a couple of other cities that soon followed. So I think the economic research that I summarized today and that the report, the written report includes, will give more color and texture to the experiences of those cities.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, Laura, thank you very much for your testimony. And just to remind viewers that this testimony is available on the state legislative website. I think we have a lot of testimony that we're putting up there, not only from today, but also from the work group process that we had during the summer. So. There is research aplenty to look at. Okay. Thank you again, Laura.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Great. Okay. Next, we have some people to talk to us about the recently concluded City Club of Portland research project into this issue. So, great. Hello, Maya. So if you could just introduce yourselves first, and then, yes.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Maria Timai, and I'm with the Portland City Club.
And my name is Ukiah Hawkins, and I'm a member of the Minimum Wage Research Committee for the City Club of Portland.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Senator Dembro and honorable members, I'd like to thank you for inviting us to speak to you today about something that influences us all. As a member of the City Club of Portland and chair of the Minimum Wage Research Committee, we found that a higher minimum wage makes sense for Portland, and we also found that cities across Oregon should be allowed to set their own minimum wage. City Club of Portland is a nonprofit, nonpartisan education and research-based organization dedicated to community service, public affairs, and leadership development. One way that the City Club informs the community is through the work of volunteer research committees.
Excuse me. Trooper? I think this is, that's his. That's yours?
That's mine.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sorry about that. You guys.
Yeah.
It has a nice seal on it.
Yeah, I got it. My girlfriend got it for me here in the gift shop.
In the gift shop.
So it's quite the cause of drama today. Anyway,
Maria. Great. Thank you.
It's a safe bag.
Yeah,
safe. So one way that the City Club informs the community is through the work of volunteer research committees, such as the one I was blessed to chair. Our committee was asked to address two questions. Is there another bag?
No. Well, go ahead.
One, should individual municipalities in Oregon be allowed to set unique minimum wage rates that are higher than the state minimum? And should Portland specifically set a higher minimum wage than the state set rate? Our answer to each question was yes. What I'll address this afternoon is how we came to our conclusions and why we believe the state needs to change the law and to allow cities to make their own decisions. So what did we do? Beginning in April, our research committee met weekly to interview 21 witnesses representing every side of the minimum wage debate and to discuss dozens of published pieces of writing on the minimum wage, such as the Dubay Report, which was mentioned by our previous witness. It was an especially auspicious time to keep track of current events, as we saw in real time the implementation of wage raises in Chicago, San Francisco, and Seattle, as well as the passing of a 15 minimum wage in LA. Economists are not in agreement on effects of raises in the minimum wage, but we carefully reviewed the most prominent and recent research. We were persuaded that a city should base its ideal minimum wage on two factors, median wage and the cost of living. These two factors are the most practical and informative benchmarks as Portland and Oregon determine the minimum wage. Our research found that the need for a higher minimum wage is significant, especially in Portland. The fix is to increase the minimum wage in Portland. However, there are two barriers. First, the state law that sets the minimum wage is not high enough for Portland. And second, state law prohibits local jurisdictions from increasing the minimum wage. The committee has concluded that local control of minimum wages is the best policy scenario, and preemption stands in its way. Local control would provide Oregon with the greatest likelihood of minimum wage that reflect Oregon's geographic diversity. Cities have an incentive to respond to this opportunity with awareness of the behavior of other cities around them. Oregonians should recognize the variation of minimum wages around the state would give both sides of the minimum wage debate new opportunities to demonstrate their cases while encouraging and rewarding policy innovation. As a practical matter, preemption has meant that the minimum wage policy is unresponsive to the significant economic variations around the state. Consequently, both sides of the minimum wage debate are denied the opportunity to demonstrate their case by applying the power of local variation. Eliminating preemption altogether is the best solution. In the long run, important advantages of local policy ownership are lost under preemption. Cities that make the conscious choice to raise their minimum wage recognize the cost of this policy experiment, even if there may be some incidental and speculative impact on surrounding communities. We had several conclusions, and I'm just going to list a few that are pertinent for us here today. The cost of living around Oregon varies significantly and is much higher in Portland than other parts of the state. For this reason, it does not make sense to insist on a single minimum wage for the entire state. Preemption impedes minimum wage policies that reflect variations in the cost of living across the state. Preemption undercuts the governing principle that underlies home rule and prevents the kind of useful and informative policy innovation that home rule is meant to encourage. The home rule principle is that the state should defer policy choices such as the minimum wage to local governments unless there is compelling evidence to the contrary. The current preemption law was supported primarily by groups seeking to slow the growth of the average minimum wage across Oregon. While proponents of preemption argue that a single statewide wage has economic benefits, we saw no convincing empirical evidence that supports this claim. Preemption is a policy position that is linked to nationwide efforts to reduce the minimum wage. Even if preemption goes away, local governments in Oregon face incentives to avoid an unworkable patchwork of minimum wage regimes. So what did we recommend? We had four recommendations. Three of them focused on Portland, but the most important one to you today is that the Oregon State Legislature should remove the statute that enables preemption in the 2016 legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, and the remaining Senator Rosenbaum, as well as the Administrator and the Assistant, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate that. We're here today to speak about the release of City Club's report on the minimum wage. We hope our testimony and the analysis and details contained therein will help the legislature to address important issues related to the minimum wage in this upcoming February session. On Friday, November 6th, City Club members had their first opportunity to vote on what had been 8 months of effort by the 10 committee members listed in the report, as well as our advisors and directors. During this time, beginning in April of 2015, we met with 21 different witnesses representing various facets of Oregon industry, academia, commerce, and even some of your legislative colleagues. Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. Our writers pored over multiple dozens of documents, 73 of which served to inform our bibliography. After this depth of research, the committee delivered a report which was overwhelmingly accepted by over 80% of our 1,500 or so members. Because of the depth and breadth of research which was covered, we recognize that this document helps to provide conclusions and recommendations which directly address structural issues of economic equity and fairness in the city of Portland, as well as throughout the state. Our findings directly address issues which are vital to the dialogue surrounding the minimum wage. The first issue is that of whether or not preemption, according to Oregon Revised Statute 653.017, should be repealed in order to allow municipalities the power of home rule to decide which wages are most pertinent to satisfy their prevailing socioeconomic conditions. The second issue was whether or not the city of Portland should raise its wages to a level above that of the current state-mandated rate of $9.25 per hour. As you can see, there is a type of conundrum here. Without answering yes to the question of preemption, the answer to the second of raising the wage in Portland is moot. The committee's answer to both questions was a solid yes. So let's talk about these 2 points. Why should the city of Portland be allowed to establish a wage above that of the current $9.25 an hour? The answer we found is, at its most distilled, an issue of fairness. Let's think about some numbers because they'll help to tell the story. A person making minimum wage at $9.25 an hour, working 40 hours a week for a year, will earn gross income of $19,240. That's a little under what you guys make per year with your per diem payments. According to Census Bureau statistics from 2010, approximately 1 out of 5 Portlanders earned that much or less. 9% earned much less, under $10,000 per year. So what does $19,240 look like for a person living in Portland? As of August 2015, the average monthly rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Portland is around $1,200 a month. This is an increase in 6 years of around $400 a month.
The lowest end apartments require a $400 minimum security deposit. This means that a person working at $9.25 an hour would have to work approximately 173 hours to be able to afford the first month's rent plus security deposit for an apartment at current market value. The question then becomes, if Portland can't promise to continue providing wages that allow for an individual to have a balance in their spending, how can it expect to maintain a robust service sector? How can Portland continue to draw the brightest minds, those directly out of college, and those seeking entry-level positions, if the money just doesn't make sense? Here's another way to think about it. You're a person making $12 an hour. At the time for your performance review, your employer offers to give you a 50-cent per hour raise because you've worked extra hard this year. That's about 4% of your overall hourly earnings. Think about this, though. In that same time since your last raise in 2013, the consumer price index in Portland has risen by over 5%. That means you're actually worth less to the company that you work for than when you first started your job. That not only doesn't seem fair, it isn't sustainable for the city of Portland. If the cost of living is much less in another city in Oregon or another state, people will go elsewhere, where they can be much more fairly compensated for their wages according to the prevailing cost of living. There are other arguments in favor of raising the minimum wage. We list 12 of them on page 19 of the report, which you have in front of you. For the sake of fairness, we also list 18 arguments in opposition to raising the minimum wage. However, after much discussion and analysis of all available information, we did find that it is in the interest of the City of Portland to seek a minimum wage which is greater than its current state preempted standard of $9.25 per hour. That does bring us to the second point which the committee discussed, that of state-level preemption. In 2001, preemption was enacted into law. One of the stated purposes of the law at the time was to ensure that large municipalities like Portland could not set a de facto statewide minimum wage. Another concern was that of a commercially burdensome patchwork of ad hoc minimum wage regulation. We found no credible arguments presented by any witness, nor any valid empirical evidence to validate these concerns, even almost 15 years after the adoption of preemption. We did find, however, that there does seem to be credible evidence for the coordination of minimum wage policy by local governments throughout the state. Municipalities cannot and should not ignore the need for communication among their bureaucratic colleagues in order to ensure that prevailing wages in their localities are consistent and fair for their citizens. Cities across the West, including Seattle, SeaTac, Tacoma, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and many others, have established wages which are higher than the prevailing wage standard set by their state. The legislature is the first venue by which compromise can be made around the issue of a minimum wage increase. We at the City Club of Portland would respectfully suggest, in the 2016 legislative session, that the legislature repeal Oregon Revised Statute 653.017. The removal of preemption, we have found, is the best option by which to support the economies of both urban Portland and all of Oregon. Portlanders need a raise. It will benefit the whole state and move all of us forward into a place of greater fairness for people of all economic status. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And at this time, we'll take any questions.
Yeah. And thank you both. Thank you for coming today and for your work, which I'm sure was uncompensated on this issue. Any questions, colleagues? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Unless somebody else wants to go first this time, I'm really, I'm okay with that.
No, no.
Okay. I think I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that people will go and move to where, you know, it makes more sense for them to be, such as if the cost of living is lower in another municipality, that they might move there. And then I think what you were saying is that, which makes it difficult for employers to fill positions, and that's where employers decide to offer more on their own, usually to attract workers. So I guess I'm a little confused why the government needs to say this needs to be the wage that we have workers attracted when employers can do that themselves
right,
to attract the best and brightest.
I do understand the concern about restricting employers from having options. I also recognize that people go where the money is. And if the money doesn't make sense for them to stay in Portland or move to Portland, they'll leave or they won't come. I mean, it's I don't want to say it's basic economics because that would insult you, and I wouldn't want to say that. But there is an argument to be made that if we don't increase the minimum wage in the city of Portland, we don't provide what could be considered closer to a living wage, that will act as a detractor for in-migration for people of a certain status. And we won't be able to fill important positions like the service sector economies that we need. That's so important to providing such economic diversity in the city of Portland. Does that help to answer your question?
No, not really, but you tried. Thank you. And I guess I have another comment. I used to work in Portland,
sure.
But I didn't live in Portland.
Sure.
So how do you ensure that you want to focus on the people who live in Portland, I take it. How do you ensure that only Portland people, is that your goal to have these jobs provided only to people who live in that umbrella of you know, where the wage might be a little different than the rest of the state?
Our goal is to allow cities to be able to make their own choices based on median wage and cost of living. And that, there is the concern of what is been dubbed the patchwork, where if you live in one area, then what about the adjacent areas around there? And does that create a patchwork of different perhaps wages and then different cost of living? And the truth is that patchwork is there now. But our point is that cities should be allowed to be able to make their own choices after they do the analysis on median wage and cost of living. Is that any more helpful?
Well, I heard what you said. I just wondered how you answer that disparity of people living outside the area not having to participate in that high cost of living in Portland. They're living in a lower cost area, but then partaking of a higher wage. Then there going to be another step to put it, some sort of citizenship, of the Portland area.
I would definitely say that what benefits Portland also benefits the surrounding areas. What benefits Portland benefits Gresham, benefits Hillsborough, benefits Clackamas County. So if Portland has the opportunity to raise its wage, which does show to increase revenue for the city, as well as it increases fairness and it increases capacity for spending for people living in Portland, I would refer to my previous statement. What benefits Portland, benefits Gresham, benefits Hillsborough, benefits Clackamas, benefits all of the surrounding areas. And we want to benefit Portland because the people that live in Portland are very important. I live in Portland. Maria lives in Portland. Some of you live in Portland. We do recognize that Portland needs a higher wage, and we do recognize the multiplier effect on the economy benefits everyone. And that's hopefully an answer to your question.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming today.
Thank you for your
questions, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Thank you.
Unless there are any other questions, let's move on to the next panel. Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
So our next panel, we have Sarah Joannides, Mike Townsend, Sean Searin, and Andrew Bornstein, please. I got a cool. If you don't mind taking a risk.
All right. Good to meet you.
All right, so what we have here is four representatives of Oregon businesses, and we want to get your different perspectives on this issue. And we'll start with Sarah, please.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Joannides. I'm the Director of Social Responsibility for New Seasons Market. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of raising the minimum wage in Oregon. New Seasons Market was founded 15 years ago with a single store in the Raleigh Hills neighborhood of Portland. Today, we have 16 stores in Oregon, over 3,000 employers, and we're one of the state's largest private employers.
We believe and have always believed that businesses are fundamentally connected to the prosperity of the communities that they serve. We believe, and we've been founded on the idea, that business can be a force for good, that we can serve our customers, our staff, our communities, and our planet, all while building a healthy regional food economy and building a healthy, profitable business. And part of our belief system is a value on our staff. We believe our staff is our greatest asset. They're the reason for our success, the reason our customers come back to us year after year and remain loyal. And so for that reason, we've always had a very progressive strategy around compensation. We wanted to pair together fair wages and a really robust and industry-leading benefits package. And we were very proud of that total compensation package that we created. In fact, for over a decade, we've had our internal starting wages at a higher level than the Oregon minimum wage. But recently, we've become very concerned about cost of living in Oregon, and specifically the cost of living in Portland, where our stores are located. More and more, with more frequency lately, we're hearing stories from staff members who tell us they just can't keep up with their bills. You know, whether or not it's childcare, food, transportation, clothing, just the basics they're having a tough time with. And the thing that the most common theme that we're hearing is around housing. Now, I'm sure everyone has read reports of rents skyrocketing in Portland, and that's very real. There's a very real impact on our staff members. And what they're telling us is that they have to move further and further away from where they work. And we actually believe at New Seasons that it's important for our staff to be able to live and thrive in the communities where our stores are located. But it's about more than just those stories we're hearing from our staff. Clearly, the data reinforces how serious this situation has become. You've heard a lot of data thrown around today. What we have looked at in the past at New Seasons, we've used the MIT Living Calculator. So you've heard that term, Living Calculator, earlier today. It's just a model that tells you sort of what covers the basics, food, transportation, clothing, healthcare, et cetera. Just the basics. And if you were to have looked at the MIT calculator as we did in 2014, what you would have seen for a single individual with no children was a living wage for the state of Oregon as an average of $9.42. If you looked at that same calculator this spring, which is when it was updated, was in May of this year, for the state of Oregon, again, for just a single individual without any dependents, that figure rose to $10.68. And that's a 13% increase in 1 year. And for us, as we dug more deeply and more narrowly and looked at just the area for Portland, the Portland metro area where we operate our stores, the cost of living there, the living wage, is $11.25. And that's a full $2 above the current minimum wage. So for a company that is dedicated to our staff, is dedicated to progressive compensation, it was a really difficult thing for us to realize that we were not keeping up. We weren't doing our part, and wages were getting ahead of us. So we made a decision that we were going to raise our minimum wage, or excuse me, our internal starting wage, to $12 an hour starting in January of 2016. That's a 20% increase over where our internal starting wage was before, which was at $10. So that's a very significant investment we chose to make in our staff. But we think it's only the first step. We know we have further to go. And that's why we're standing together with a growing number of businesses that are calling for broader public policy solution to raise the minimum wage for all Oregonians. You know, I think it's a common misperception that all businesses are against raising wages. I don't think that's the reality that I've seen as I've talked to business owners across the state over the last 6 months. There are some businesses that will say we can't afford to raise wages. Our experience at New Seasons is that when we invest in our staff, we reap the rewards of retention and loyalty and engagement, and that translates into the experience the customer has in our store, and that translates to our bottom line. So I'm here today advocating for an increase in the minimum wage in Oregon that follows three common sense principles. The first is that businesses need a level playing field for competition. We do not believe that individual businesses acting alone in a piecemeal approach can make significant change in policy. We believe, in fact, that businesses such as ours that pay higher wages shouldn't have to compete against other businesses paying low wages that are essentially being subsidized by taxpayer-funded public assistance programs. We think the tide must rise for all ships, which is why we believe that statewide public policy is the right path forward. The second point is that we believe the policy must account for regional differences in cost of living. While we do support a path towards a $15 wage in the Portland market, we know that cost of living is very different across the state, and what works in Portland may not work for Coos Bay or for Baker City. In fact, it could be unsustainable for businesses there and for their economy. And as a company that values our long-term partners, growers, producers, ranchers, fishermen across the state of Oregon, resolving the issue of regional cost of living differences, is of the utmost importance to us. The third principle is that these increases should be phased in over time, as we've seen in Seattle and San Francisco, so that businesses can plan and budget accordingly in a sustainable fashion. We firmly believe that the legislature is the right place to address this issue. As you've heard from all the testimony today, this is an incredibly complex issue, and we believe it requires a very thoughtful and nuanced approach that only the legislature can bring. So we would hope to see this on the legislative agenda in 2016. Chair Dembrough, I'm happy to hear you say that it will be there and that hopefully it will not be deferred to the ballot but will be resolved in 2016. I thank you for inviting my testimony today, and I look forward to supporting the process and working with you towards a legislative solution that will raise the minimum wage for all Oregonians in 2016. Thank you, and I assume we'll hold questions until my cohorts have had a chance to speak.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Mr. Townsend, you're up next.
My name is Mike Townsend. My family and I own Townsend Farms. I'm here representing Northwest Food Processors. One of my friends here, David Truitt, is here today from his company. The first thing I'd like to say is Townsend Farms is a family-based company with over eight generations in Oregon. My grandson is the eighth generation. My wife handles the human resources. I help with the sales with my daughter, Heidi, and my son. Worked for 2 days, and he says, Dad, I'm not going to work with you. I don't want to. And he started his own fresh market business within the company. Currently, Billy's fresh market business competes with people like Driscoll, billion-dollar companies. I don't know how he did it, but he convinced the retailers to deal with a small grower. We're a little bit larger now. We deal with other growers, a number of other growers in the area, over 200 growers in the area. We are the largest frozen fruit packer in the state of Oregon, humbly speaking, and thankful to God for it. Purpose today is to talk about the concerns. I don't like to use the word negative. I like to talk about the word concerns of the minimum wage increase and how it would affect Oregon ag. Agriculture is, of course, a large part of the Oregon economy. And I think I got an email from over 200,000 employees. Is that correct? Yeah. Over 200,000 skilled jobs in Oregon.
In food processing?
In food processing. Yeah. I would say that if it's $6 billion worth of business, 10 years ago there might have been 15 businesses. Today I could put $3 billion in the room with six businesses, meaning that I'm sorry, but there's been consolidation in our business. It's a very competitive business. We have five different companies that need to make money for us to compete in a world market. We grow 1,500 acres of berries, raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, and black raspberries. We have two labor housing facilities and a motel. We fought the public for For probably 2 to 3 years, we spent over $450,000 in legal fees to get labor housing in North Plains, Oregon, and Fairview, Oregon. And we now have a motel in Grants Pass. It's been there for 15 years. We don't have any problems with labor. The labor lives there for free. It's worth about $2 an hour. It's not a secret. If you take care of people, we feel they're going to take care of you. We've added jobs in the fresh market and the frozen side of the business. Collectively, when I got involved with the business, there was about $100,000 in sales. I mean, in employment. Now there's over $22 million. So how have we survived in a world economy? Well, we've done it by when you introduced the CPI. I got nervous. I wanted our company to survive. 65% of the people that work for us have living wage jobs. So being an Oregonian and being here for as long as I have, I wanted to save those jobs. We went to Vineland, New Jersey. The minimum wage rate was lower. We started with 40 employees, and today we've got 130. And we've invested a considerable amount of money in that state. We still love Oregon. We're not going anywhere. But today I can tell you that Townsend Farms competes with $2 billion companies. One is Dole Foods, which is over $3 billion in sales. And SunOpta, which is one of the larger companies in Canada, just bought out one of our competitors for $450 million. Now, I can tell you that with zero-sum years to 3.5% margin, a lot of times when we don't make any money, I make a joke and I say we're a holding company for our assets. So a holding company for your assets means I didn't have a very good year this year. Last year I had 3.5%. So I make myself feel good. And Peter and David, I think you might be able to agree with me, since you moved to Kentucky, that part of your operation, that I love these employees and I wanna keep these 500 people in Oregon. I really do, and I love these people. We've given them dignity, and they've been a great asset to us, and we have a great workforce. But how do I compete on a global basis with billion-dollar companies? And some of the people I compete with from Chile and Mexico with $2 an hour wages. It's me and my daughter. If my daughter and I buy it, a Townsend sells it, and my son runs a fresh market, and my wife does human resources. I'm not asking for anybody's help, and I certainly understand where these people are coming from. My heart goes out to them. When I was 20, I had a job, and I had insurance, and lost my oldest son. If it wasn't for the insurance, I wouldn't be here today. So I totally get their passion for the people in this state. But I want to tell you that if we want to do some of these things, it's all about free trade. It's all about free trade. And free trade would get us higher wage rates, but that's not the way the federal government has set all this up. I spoke with a number of my larger customers, and I said, you know, I want to do what's right. I want to take a positive step forward because I love this state. And a lot of them wouldn't say a whole lot to me because this is a political situation. I won't mention any names of the retailers. But I can tell you this much, that a family like Blue Heron Farms, who's one of my largest growers, the Truett brothers, who are specialty packers, Norpak Foods, Frank Teague owns Oregon Onion, or Oregon, was it Oregon? Do you remember the name of the company? National Frozen Foods. They're a $1.3 billion company. They've consolidated five other companies. We used to have seven vegetable processors, and now we only have two. Two of my competitors in the frozen industry didn't diversify into the cold storage and the growing, and Flavorland Foods and Carriage House Foods are no longer here anymore. So I'm here to try to protect those jobs, and at the same time, I have a deep sympathy and understanding for those people that spoke earlier. I'd say going forward that I talked to one of the leaders in the industry, and he said this to me. He says, you know, Mike, I can pull certain things out of certain places. He'll go unnamed. But he says, what I really like to see is something happen more like Washington, where they didn't affect the rest of their state. They let Seattle have that wage rate for a while. Senator Rosenbaum, you posed a very good question about job loss. Nobody ever came to Townsend Farms and asked us about the job loss or us moving to another state. They weren't going to do that. I had to move on. I was working in a low return business that I love, but I think the real difficulty with all this here, everybody, is that we don't know what we're going to lose. And I think that what I'd like to propose is that we get five or six of the larger employers that are doing maybe $3 or $4 billion in ag, and get them in the room with our governor. And I did this before with Kate Brown when Governor Kulongoski was in office. And it's, I mean, I think we need each other. And I think somebody needs to stand here. Okay? Not there, but here. That's where we need to stand. We need to stand in the middle. Okay? We need to have deference for one another. Okay? I have extreme deference to those people. Okay? I want you to know that. But I have extreme love for the people that work for me. And so does everybody in this industry. We have about 10 major companies now. And in saying that, I hope you'll... This is almost funny. One of the things that our customers want is organic fruit. So I'm running around trying to buy farms growing organic product. Because you know where most of organic comes from? Third world countries. Because of the labor cost. So what I'm trying to do is grow organics in Oregon. Okay? So... Oh, it costs a lot more in labor to grow organics. So at the same time, I'm making this investment. And at the same time, I don't know how it's going to turn out. I mean, I got a lot of money invested in organics. I don't expect people to feel sorry for me, but I certainly want to do what's right for my customer base, and I certainly don't want to keep bringing everything in from out of the country. Does that make... I mean, I hope... I use that as an example. I do really think that we need to call on other people in this industry that are neutral. I talked to Bruce Forte from Oregon State University. He wrote a beautiful letter for me, but I'm not going to have time to read it. But I think we need to engage some people like from the Legislative Fiscal Office, or Oregon Ag Economist to come up with numbers so we can understand each other's issues and move forward collectively to make Oregon the great state that it is. And I will leave you with this. I have an industrial park that Ted Kulongoski blessed. It was shovel ready. I prayed that we get some manufacturing jobs and none came. They were all in the trucking industry. And I still have over half the property left. I'm just a farm boy, but it makes sense to me. If you want people to come here, you create manufacturing zones for housing, like they did in Wood Village. I happen to live in one of those houses. There's 200 acres there, and they had small houses that were about 800 square feet. I lived in one of those houses, and the kids that went to Reynolds High School. They named it Reynolds High School after Reynolds Metals. Those people lived in those houses. It was close to where they worked. Part of our problem right here, right now, is housing in Portland. We've got too constricted of an area for these people. The Gresham police chief is my next door neighbor. He says, Mike, I went over to talk to him last night. He says, Mike, you know, there's one thing I want you to know. It's the apartments and the density piece. We need to give these people more space, but it totally goes opposite away from your thoughts about having people close to their work. Let's get some manufacturing jobs in our Tri-County area. I'm going off course, Senator, and I see, but I'm here. I want to help solve things. I don't want to be just a guy sitting here thinking certain things about the people. I love them. I want to help them, and I have a passion for it. Do you have any questions?
We'll hear from the others, okay, and then I'm sure we will. I just want to say I very much appreciate your testimony, Mr. Townsend.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sean Searin.
Senator Denver, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of raising Oregon's minimum wage. My name is Sean Searin. I'm a proud member of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, and for more than 10 years, my family has owned Biddy McGraw's Public House, I think in your district.
It is in my district, and when I heard it was owned by a man, I was shattered. I always assumed that Biddy was a woman.
Originally. Yeah. We've all heard that increasing the minimum wage will help boost local consumer spending and help 500,000 Oregonians make ends meet, but I'm here to tell you some of the reasons why raising the minimum wage would be good for my business and other small businesses. First, investing in my employees is the best investment I can make for my business. Obviously, with a well-trained, happy, and healthy, and economically secure employees to help keep our customers satisfied and coming back, small businesses like mine would not survive. We rely on our staff to grow our business, to build our customer loyalty, and to set us apart from our competition. Second, studies show that higher wages reduce absenteeism and employee turnover, and in the end, save businesses money. I can certainly testify to that. The less employee turnover, the better, for all the reasons just listed. Contrary to what I think some of the opponents will claim, the majority of small business owners do support raising the minimum wage. As a member of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, I participated in a survey last year along with hundreds of business owners like myself about a variety of issues we face. And do you know that most of us answered when asked, as a small business owner, what do you need most to create jobs and get the economy back on track? More customers. Probably a no-brainer, right? But without customers, I wouldn't have a business. And without employees, I don't have customers. And the concept behind raising the minimum wage is a simple one. One business's employees are another's customer. More money in the pockets, more employees means more paying customers for small business and more money being spent in our local economy. More than two-thirds of us also support raising Oregon's minimum wage for that very reason. Many of us also came from working families, myself certainly included, and know what it's like to struggle to pay the bills even though you're working hard. We want to make sure that our employees able to take care of their families and even have perhaps a little left over to save for the future or for schooling costs or to go to a pub. Oregon's economy is powered by small businesses, as you know, and paying employees a living wage for their hard work is one of the most effective things we can do to strengthen our economy. Raising the minimum wage isn't just good for my employees or for my business, it's also good for our state budget. Currently, taxpayers spend over $1 billion every year to subsidize the profits of large corporations that pay their workers' wages so low that they have to rely on public assistance to make ends meet. Most low-wage workers in Oregon are employed by businesses with 50 or more employees, not small businesses like mine. Walmart, McDonald's, ACS Sprint, and Safeway, all out-of-state corporations, are among Oregon's top five employers of DHS clients receiving food stamps. As a small business paying my fair share of taxes, I'm appalled to know, frankly, that my hard-earned tax dollars are subsidizing these large corporations who don't pay their employees enough to work to afford basic necessities. As Oregonians, We believe in the dignity of work. I'm proud to own a business that employs people and supports our local economy. We believe that when you work full-time, you should be self-sufficient and you should be able to take care of your family. There's no reason for this to be a partisan issue either. All workers deserve to be paid a wage that keeps them out of poverty, whether they work in a kitchen or behind a bar, whether they're tending the fields or they grow our food or caring for our aging parents. As a business owner, it's clear to me that raising Oregon's minimum wage is critical to strengthening our local economy and creating an environment that supports small businesses and entrepreneurs. It's clear that raising the wage in Oregon is the right thing to do, morally and economically. It's the right thing for business and our communities, ensuring that everyone has the ability to thrive in the communities where they live and where they work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Sean. Mr. Bornstein.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee. My name's Andrew Bornstein. I'm representing Bornstein Seafoods. We're an 81-year-old seafood processing company, originally founded in the Great Depression in Bellingham, Washington. We came to Oregon in 1979 as we expanded our presence. Currently in Oregon, we operate in Astoria, Newport, and Brookings. I think currently on the West Coast, we do operate from around Eureka, California to Southeast Alaska. In Astoria, where I'm from, we employ about 150 people. We had a payroll last year of around $8 million. And while that, if you do the quick math on that, is somewhere around a $40,000 average salary, there are some, you know, a good third of our company is minimum wage jobs. And a lot of these people are their first jobs or their first job in a while, so to speak. And a lot of them are very basic labor of putting fish in boxes, freezing. It's ag work. At times, we also temp labor is a major issue that we just don't have enough labor force, period, in Astoria. We pull employees from Longview, Kelso, Portland, all over just to get people in our canneries. It's a major issue just finding bodies. And I don't think if we raised it to $15 or $50 an hour, it would change that equation. There are just so many people that are interested in the fish processing business. It's a very rough way of life. I want to talk a little bit about kind of some of the things that were hit on. Two examples. One that I used a while ago was we do shrimp. And when I say shrimp, it's little salad shrimp, the Oregon pink shrimp, the first sustainably certified shrimp in the world. We did about 15 million pounds of that shrimp, and that takes about 45 employees. I've been to the fish plants in Iceland where they have a very high minimum wage, where it takes five people to do that same amount of work. I'm not saying that $15 is the magic trigger where I have to go and buy those robots and those machines to reduce my labor force from 45 to 5, but it certainly gets that conversation going. There are trade-offs. In my MBA program, I had the privilege of going through a Toyota GM co-plant in California where they had robotic arms doing all the spot welds. And then a month later, I got to go to India and see the exact same plant that was a JV between Toyota and General Motors. And they had humans doing all those. And it looked like very horrible work with a lot of sparks. Their safety requirements there were very low. And we all jumped out. Why is there 100 people there where you have the robots? And they said, quite frankly, well, the wage. It's $2 an hour, and those are $2 million machines you saw. Back in California, they're making $50 an hour. So there are trade-offs. My point to that story is that happens every day here in Oregon. In Astoria, I work at the base of the Megler Bridge. I'm literally connected to Washington. So if we go to $15 an hour and they're at $10 an hour in Owako and Chinook, I'm immediately massively disadvantaged to the seafood processing world. Second, I want to respond, I guess, so to speak, to some of the claims earlier about when we raised 60% in the 80s and 90s and that didn't affect jobs. Well, maybe not as a net whole, but in my business, in the ag sector, it was extremely impactful. We've done the analysis because we are proud that we made it to 81 years, so we just kind of took a stock of the situation and looked around, and we charted the seafood industry from the 80s in Oregon, specifically Oregon, Washington coast, in the 80s to 2010, and it went from 35 companies. There's three really seafood companies of note left on the Oregon coast, and one of them is the billion-dollar one, and the rest of us are well behind him in their wake. Another story, that's worth noting is, you know, my company, we pride ourselves on being progressive. We were the first company to employ women in our factories in the flay lines in the 40s during World War II. When labor got really short, we were the first ones to offer health care to employees and 401ks to employees, just to differentiate ourselves from the same guy next door offering $5 an hour or $8 an hour or whatever the progression was. And we also pride ourselves that within 2 weeks, we can identify if you're a person that wants to be there and is committed and can learn. And the more we say it right up front, the more you learn, the more you make, the more you skills you bring to yourself, and more valuable we encourage you know, all of our employees to make themselves so valuable to us that we can't afford to ever let them go for any dollar an hour. And then the last one I want to just note on is, to this day, it is still cheaper to pull a salmon off the coast of Oregon, freeze it, send it to China, thaw it out over there, fillet it, portion it into 8-ounce portions, freeze it again, float it back to our, you know, back to America, and give that to the TGI Fridays or the Applebee's or even the pub that doesn't have someone that can fillet and hand portion fish on hand. It's still cheaper to do that today, already, at the current minimum wage levels. We've been fighting it, and labor is just one component. The other major cost is, you know, the boat price and labor. And I think Mr. Townsend, if that was your name, I'm sorry if I missed it.
Call me whatever you want.
Mike? I've got Mike. He said a number that stuck with me, 3.5%. Yeah, that's a good year for us, 3.5%. We can push around hundreds of millions of pounds of fish, and if we make 3.5% on it, we think we're doing good. And there are a lot of years it's -2 or -5 or just zero. I get the holding capital thing is that we're just making the mortgage payments, hoping someday we own our buildings, and we keep the 150, 200 people employed. I mean, it's not... You know, I'm not, I guess, a small business anymore. We're past 50 people, but we're not a big corporation. We're certainly not Walmart by any, stretch of the imagination. But the only way we can solve, if we go $15 an hour tomorrow, that's great. I need new seasons to double the prices and the volume you're buying of my soul. Someone's got to do it. And that's the part I don't understand in this. Personally, I'm not an economist. I'm just a guy raised on the docks. If we go to $15 an hour, I have to sell our fish for more. So how does that not just exacerbate the current problem where everyone can't afford their basic necessities? That's what I just don't get. If we go to $15 statewide, isn't gas going to cost more for the fuel pumper? Isn't my food that we produce, the fish, that's going to cost more? So aren't cherries going to start costing more? Isn't everything cost more right where we started? So now I get it. We're just poverty as a whole is this enormous subject that is entirely too complicated to solve here today. But I guess I can be here as a voice of neutral. I'm not sure I'm saying you should not do 15 or you should do. I just don't understand how it doesn't raise the cost of goods on everything. I don't understand how it doesn't incentivize me to make more of my employment base in Washington and California or in the regions. And, you know, Astoria and Coos Bay, I mean, I know 101. I know Astoria to Coos Bay like the back of my hand. And Brookings, sorry. We're not Portland, and a fit for Portland is not a fit for the coast. We're a very different community. That's getting to the point of just almost resentment that a fit for Portland will fix everything out there on the coast. It's not that way. And we have a housing shortage in Astoria right now. Try finding an apartment in Astoria. You can't. We're looking to rent out blocks of hotels, too, to see if that's the solution to getting people that want to work. Thank you.
I've got one of Grant's pass for you.
Not enough fish.
Okay, before I open it up to questions, I just want to thank you all for your testimony. And I think you can see what a difficult situation, you know, what a difficult set of decisions we have ahead of us here as we're trying to deal with this. Because, you know, you hear the need on the part of the workers, and, you know, we certainly don't want to do things that will, jeopardize business. We want to do things that will do the greatest good for the greatest number. And so let me just open it up to questions, and if not, I have a couple. Okay. Sarah, your testimony showed that, you know, you're thinking about wanting to raise the wage for your workers in order for them to be able to manage their lives. And, you know, and you'd like us to do it in a way that we're things will be predictable and you'll be able to plan for it over a number of years. And, you know, I think the wage cost is certainly something you can predict. But presumably, you know, if you're getting frozen food from towns and farms, they may have to boost up their prices a little bit, or the sole from Bornstein Seafood. How do you think your company will take that into account and deal with it?
Thanks for your question, Chair Dumbro. We're actually happy to do business and have done business over the years with Bornstein Seafood. And I think that the answer lies in the fact that we found our customers are very concerned and interested where their food comes from and how their food is how it's raised, how it's produced, how it's grown, where it comes from, how the companies that raise their food and produce their food treat their workers, pay their workers. And were we to pay more for fish from Mr. Bornstein or more frozen for frozen fruit or from a different fruit from one of the great companies that you spoke of, I think our customers would understand what they're paying for, that they're paying for the true cost of that food. I think, though, that the issue really highlighted here is that the two issues, really. One is that cost of living is dramatically different across different areas of the state. Andrew, you and I agree completely on that fact that what fits for Portland may not fit, could be very damaging to an area like Astoria or Coos Bay. And so for that reason, a policy that is responsive to different areas of the state, a regional policy of some kind related to cost of living is very important. And I also think it underscores the fact that this is an incredibly complex, as you said, all of the different issues raised at the table today show how complex an issue this is. And for that reason, we really are counting on our legislators to create a thoughtful solution for that in the upcoming session.
Thank you. And a question maybe for you, Andrew, or for Ms. Townsend. This question, you know, Sean raised the point that we have a situation where people are relying on public services for, you know, just in order to cope as families. How is that fair, or how do we address it? I mean, is that fair that you know, that taxpayers in general should be supporting families because they're working full time, but they're not able to support themselves? I mean, what is the answer to that? I mean, we need people to do this minimum wage work, whether it's in the service sector or if it's in or in processing or whatever. We need people to be doing those jobs, so. How do we make sure that they can, you know, earn a living?
I don't mean to be glib when I answer it this way. However, it's a very complex question. I don't think I have the true answer to. But one such way to make it not tax dollars paying for these things is to leave more of the money with the businesses so that they can afford to pay their employees more. We could get rid of a state income tax. I know that's not going to happen. But we could lower the effective corporate income tax so we're not paying 44% of our profits to the government, and then we'd have more money to pay employees. At the bit, you know, there's 1,000 things that go between a gross $1 sale and the 3.5 cents, you know, that someone
makes. Remember, we can only deal with the state part of that.
Right? So that's why I got to ask for state income tax. You can get rid of that. I'll put more money in the pockets that you can pay, you know, because I would like to, you know, New Seasons, for instance, they compete with Safeways and all these others, and they pay their employees more. I would presume they believe, and it may be a fact, that means you have better employees than the other grocery stores. Well, if I paid $3 an hour more, I'm pretty sure I could get the better fish processing employees on the Oregon coast than my competitors. But that is the difference between going forward or backwards. And waterfront properties on piers, the repairs and maintenance alone are atrocious. Talk to the Port of Astoria about their issues on that right now, but I digress.
I'd urge all of you to go to YouTube and pick up Thomas Sowell. He's an economist. It would really help you if you gain some insight from him. In his words, we're not paying a minimum wage. We are paying a wage for skills. And when I say that, the people that are coming into Oregon that are coming to pick the berries, they're not making minimum wage and haven't made minimum wage for probably 6 or 7 years because they have a skill. And they get paid for that skill. And what we need to do is come together as a country and help people with their skills. And if you look real closely, agriculture is your friend, according to the Oregon State Economist, because agriculture is the leading employer for folks that are new into the workplace. So we're your friends because they usually get started in ag, because ag's the biggest employer for people that start businesses. The deal with your company is I have to deal with national people that are $100 billion in sales, and so I have pressure from these conglomerates that are billion-dollar companies to be accountable to them. That means I have to have a decent price. And I'd love to sell to your company, but my problem is I have to create large runs of product because I'm kind of like a manufacturer. I run 10 shifts a day, and it's hard for me to. And I don't want your. I mean, I want your business, but you got to understand is the businesses are so mature now in this industry, in this country. It's not an easy answer. But I think if we come together and help people get paid by their skills, not coming to the table and saying, I want a living wage with very little skills to offer the employer. And I want to say that in the most loving way.
Can I just add on to that in one sentence? Yeah. It's in the shrimp. If the shrimp plant example is exactly that, and if our minimum wage goes, we can put it to $50 an hour, to process the same amount of seafood, you know, we did last year, it'll still be an $8 million payroll. It'll just be spread over 100 people instead of 150 people. And that's where I don't understand this no job loss will happen. It will in the manufacturing industry because we pay for skills. We're just going to require higher skills, and there'll be computer operators, and everyone will make 60 or 70 grand a year, but they'll have the skill set requisite for that price.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming forward and having such a thoughtful discussion on this.
And, I would personally invite any of you that are interested in your facility, watch what we're doing. If you have any questions about that, and I wish you would engage the governor. We really need to take a leadership role. Leaders in business need to do that. Thank you very much.
I promise to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, our final panel. We've been talking around the issue of preemption, and so now it's our time to actually dig into it in our last half hour. And so we have Scott Winkles, who's going to give us the perspective of the League of Oregon Cities, and Mike Nesbitt from Papa's Pizzas. Great to see you again, Mike. And Caitlin Baggett from the North Star Civic Foundation, which has been working on this for the last year or so. Scott, you want to start?
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities is a statewide association of all 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon, and we represent them as a collective interest. I don't think my testimony would be shocking to anyone. The League of Oregon Cities is opposed to preemptions on the control of on their ability to govern. The voters of Oregon, well over 100 years ago, installed a provision in the Constitution that guaranteed the home rule authority of Oregon cities. We are a strong home rule state, meaning that the state city is free to regulate as it chooses. In what we call a show me where I can't scenario. So there has to be a preemption on local control in order to prohibit a state for a city from actually enacting an ordinance. You know, we like to say in the league that Lakeview and Lake Oswego are very different places, but they are governed by people who do take a great deal of interest in their businesses, in the people who work there, and the people who live there, and giving the cities the authority to regulate on something as important as a quality of life issue like minimum wage seems to make sense to us, because who knows better what that community needs than the people who the governor who were elected closest to the people. And that is the philosophy the league has always taken in this on this matter. Conversely, I think we would be also concerned about a statewide mandate to a wage that was unsustainable. I think we were asked to do a fiscal impact statement early in the session on the $15 an hour minimum wage, and we found that it was beyond our capability to actually calculate how much that would cost cities in terms of PERS rates, roll-ups on salary, and whatnot. And I would encourage you to keep in mind that cities are going to be experiencing a significant cost in their human resources costs due to the PERS increases and other factors moving forward. And I would encourage you to respect the fact that Oregon has traditionally respected the rights of cities to govern their own affairs, and would suggest that this preemption be lifted.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Chair Dembrow, Vice Chair Thatcher, committee members. My name is Mike Nesbitt, and I'm here as one of the few wanting to voice my opposition to the lifting of the preemption statute. I hope to present some rational and, from my point of view, real-world reasons why you shouldn't do this. I've worked for Papa's Pizza for over 40 years, and I thought I knew my mostly minimum wage workforce pretty well. But this past Saturday, they managed to surprise the heck out of me. Out of 66 employees at the employee meeting last Saturday, in a completely anonymous survey, two thought the job they held was worth $15 an hour. Following the vote, we had a discussion about the minimum wage, and they were making the exact case against raising the minimum wage that I would make. They were so persuasive that I'm thinking about renting a bus and bringing them all up here to testify. If you lift the preemption statute, you would allow a handful of sometimes progressive city council members to side with those two against the 64. It wouldn't be done by a vote of the people, but would instead be accomplished through the actions of six or eight council members, and that's just simply not fair nor just. When you research the subject of preemption, you'll find all sorts of studies and reports and statistics, both pro and con, and you can pretty much pick any case you want with the stats. In fact, I could use perfectly legitimate statistics to show that Portland's minimum wage should be $9.74 an hour, but I doubt anybody would accept that. When it comes to preemption, I could selfishly argue that you should lift the preemption just in Portland. I don't have any restaurants there. And that would take the wind out of the sails of the higher minimum wage, statewide minimum wage crowd. But the reality is that retaining the preemption clause is important for the entire state. And it's not fair to the business owners in Portland to be saddled with an unfair wage tax. I hope you can get beyond the statistics and look at preemption from a clear, rational, common sense point of view. We have five pizza parlors. Two are in Eugene, one's in Springfield. They're separated by 5 or 10 minutes, but worlds apart in the manner in which they are treated by the cities treat the businesses. Many members of the Eugene City Council have already indicated their support of a $15 minimum wage. They were allowed to unilaterally raise minimum wage so that to that level, we would have to raise prices 12%. Other businesses will take similar steps, and that increase will likely be higher as we lose customers because of our higher prices in our Eugene stores. If Eugene imposes a 12% labor tax on businesses, those businesses will lose sales. And common sense tells you that if you can drive 5 or 10 or 15 minutes to save money, many people will do it. They'll go to grocery stores, daycare centers, auto shops in the lower cost cities. For us, in 2014, we had 220,000 hours of labor. If I have to raise even $1, that's almost $250,000 in extra labor that I have to pay for. We didn't make that much money last year. So I have to raise prices. And as the fellow from Bernstein's was saying just a minute ago, it's common sense to me that if you raise minimum wage, you're going to raise prices. Businesses across the board will. Lifting the preemption clause will result in residents, those residents who have the ability, making the choice to leave the higher cost city as the cost of living increases. That's a fact, and it's already happening. My youngest manager started working for me 8 years ago at our Springfield parlor. He transferred to Corvallis, went to OSU for 4 years, became a supervisor, and then a manager at my Corvallis parlor. Along the way, he got married, had two beautiful young girls, bought a house, and he has never made $15 an hour. He's not on public support. He does it on his own. His wife works part-time. To make all of this happen, though, he had to move out of Corvallis to buy his home and to avoid the high cost of living in the big city. And that is exactly what will happen if individual cities are allowed to raise their minimum wage. Smaller rural communities will be the only places where young families can afford the services they need. Common sense tells you that many companies, many individuals with the ability to do so will move to lower cost locations where there isn't a 12% wage tax, or 10% or 5%. Common sense tells us that you will only increase the cost of living in the high cost of living cities if wages are increased, and that will make it even harder for the citizens to afford to live there. It's not about statistics or studies, which can be twisted to suit any point of view. It's about common sense and real-world facts. Removing the preemption law works both ways, and the economy and labor force will be disrupted in both the higher-wage city and the surrounding lower-wage cities. The low-wage city residents will go to the high-wage cities. They'll still live in the low-wage cities, but they will go across the city line and work in the higher-wage city. The businesses that are in the high-wage cities, they will want to relocate if they can. If they are building a new business, they're going to go to a lower wage city. Businesses in the high wage city are going to get more competent workers, displacing the low wage workers who are already there. And then those low wage workers will have to go to the city next door and get the low wage jobs there. Businesses in high wage cities will take steps to try to remain profitable. My company's already looked at the options. Number one, we'd reduce hours of operation and save about 8 hours per day. We'd increase efficiencies, buy more prepared product, and save 6 hours per day. We'd increase the use of technology and save at least 2 hours per day. That's two full-time workers that we would eliminate, and we'd save over $87,000 a year in wages. Businesses where minimum wage is allowed to increase because the preemption law is lifted will take steps like this to reduce costs. Workers will suffer and jobs will be displaced to surrounding lower wage cost cities. Even liberal city councilors struggle with the cost of raising minimum wage. Claire Surratt, Eugene City Council, and Amanda Fritz, Portland City Council, have both expressed concerns about the impact of higher minimum wage on city budgets if the preemption law is lifted and wages rise. Yet those same concerns are ignored when it comes to the impact on business. The concept of preemption when it comes to wage and hours laws is a solid concept. The legislature recognized this when wage preemption was enacted in 2001, and 29 other states have the same type of preemption law. Oregon lawmakers in 2001 and lawmakers in those other states all understand the devastating and unstable impact of a multitude of wage laws throughout the state, with those wage laws often left up to the whims of city councils. Why would we ever allow a handful of city councilors to make a change to state law resulting in a 60% increase to the cost of labor? We have to face the reality that removing the preemption law could easily result in artificially increasing the cost of local services to random levels in various cities throughout the state based upon a flawed and dangerous interpretation of the purpose behind setting a minimum wage. I respectfully ask you to retain the Oregon Statute 653.017. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. Caitlin.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Caitlin Baggett. I'm the Executive Director of the North Star Civic Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about regional differences in economies throughout Oregon and the concept of a regional wage. For those of you who've heard the hour-long version of these points, you'll be relieved to know that I've shortened them. I believe, if I push this, yes. It is abundantly clear that Oregon's different regional economies require a minimum wage solution that is more nuanced than one size fits all. Lifting preemption is one way to achieve that goal. It is not the only way. Over the last 10 months, our foundation has funded research, interviews, and community listening sessions throughout Oregon with more than 200 employers and community leaders. Our aim was to understand better regional differences in the economy and dig into the reality that we've all heard today, that maybe $15 an hour will work in Portland, but it would be a different story in rural parts of the state. Our approach is focused on understanding the right structure, not picking a number, a ceiling, or a floor. However, the data we've analyzed does offer some guidance on those questions. The legislature can act to develop pragmatic, compassionate, and economically sound minimum wage policy separately from deciding the fate of the preemption law. By using Oregon's existing economic districts and broadly accepted data, Oregon can develop a regional wage solution that is simple, rational, better for low-paid Oregonians, and more responsive to the state's rural economies. Three bodies of information support this approach: the local cost of living, what it takes to pay the bills each month, the health of local economies, and the regional connections between them. I'll go through these slides relatively quickly. You have them for the record and quite a few more. First, cost of living has been a central part of the argument to raise the wage. Both campaigns point to cost of living throughout the state as a primary justification for their cause. And research from many sources paints a common picture for the state of Oregon. It costs less to live in Douglas or Polk or Morrow County than it does in Lane County or the greater Portland area or in Hood River. Indeed, a quick look at Craigslist shows that a one-bedroom apartment in Portland this week is $1,500. Whereas in a smaller town, it's $600. I've pulled out Multnomah, Linn, and Deschutes County on this slide as examples of high-cost, low-cost, and medium-cost regions in the state, and they'll be highlighted on each slide I go through. But cost of living can't be the only factor that we use to decide what the minimum wage should be. If it was, we'd set the wage at $100 an hour and call it good. We also need an indicator of the impact of a wage on a regional economy. Both conservative and liberal economists agree that one indicator of a normal or average minimum wage is the relationship between that minimum and the median in an area. When the minimum wage is half of the median, that is average for economies all over the world, now and in history. Economists frequently also see economies in which the minimum wage is as high as 65% of the median wage. This slide shows what that 50 to 65% range looked like in Oregon in 2014. For the sake of simplicity, I'll call it the minimum wage safe zone, but we should be clear that when economists are talking about this average, they cannot say what happens above or below it. All they are saying is the prevalence of economies that fit that model. Using this scale, in Washington County in 2014, the minimum wage of $9.25 an hour was below average, while in Clatsop County, it was in the middle of the range and slightly above average. Looking at cost of living as a static idea is also a little bit imperfect. It's important to understand that cost of living has been rising quickly in many parts of Oregon. And rising more quickly in some places than others. In Multnomah County, the cost of living climbed 23% over the last 3 years, whereas in Linn County, that was 9%. In Malheur, it was only 1% a year.
But if we project all of this data forward to 2019, this is what we see. Although I should note that on this slide, I've increased both the safe zone and the cost of living line at the same rate of 2.1% annually, even though I just said that it's rising more quickly in some areas than others. For the purpose of illustration, this shows roughly what we could expect things to look like in 2019. And this is how the two current proposals compare to the state economy projected forward. But how big are each of these areas? How many low-paid workers would be affected in each one? I've broken up the state into a couple of chunks. You can see that 44.5% of low-paid jobs in Oregon are in just three counties, the three counties that have the highest cost of living and the highest median wage. You can also see that in 2019, 1350, sort of the middle line there, and $15 are both well within the safe zone, but at $13.50, that number would not be sufficient for a low-paid worker to earn a decent living. In other areas of the state, it may be the right level. In some areas, it may be outside of that economic safe zone. There is no denying that hardworking people struggle to make ends meet in every county in Oregon. But in the greater Portland area, the need to raise the minimum wage is urgent and immediate, and affects nearly half of Oregon's low-paid workers. In other parts of the state, a slower path toward a higher wage may be more appropriate, both as a measure of the needs of workers in that area and as a way to protect rural economies that are still emerging from the recession. A regional wage policy need not be overly complex or difficult to manage, and there are several sound options for how to do it. The simplest of them would be to use the state's current prevailing wage districts as the geographic basis for three or four on-ramps toward a higher minimum wage, a fast track in the Portland metro area, a slightly slower path in wage districts with connected mid-sized cities, and a slow path in areas with high levels of unemployment, low cost of living, and a sluggish recovery from the recent recession. This option uses an existing legal framework for setting the wage, the prevailing wage district, and does not necessarily change the preemption law, although that law could still be evaluated on its own merits. It affords an opportunity for increased wages in every part of the state, giving all Oregonians a path toward an income to start a life, raise a family, and contribute as a valued citizen. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on these slides. I know I went through them very quickly.
Thank you very much, Caitlin. Anybody have clarifying questions? Or?
I know. At some point, I would like to add something, but
okay. Yes, so Senator Gelser.
Just on the charts themselves, mm-hmm. just so that I know that I'm reading them correctly. What is there a growth point on here? I'm trying to find the slide again that looks at the rate of growth, or is that slide identical to the slide below and you've just added the rate of growth there? Is there a reference point on that chart to show the rate of growth that I'm not seeing?
So the this chart shows both that chunk, the safe zone, and the line, the cost of living, increased by 2.1% annually between now and 2019. So they're just moved up on the slide, unless they don't appear to be.
They appear to be, so the regional economic health comparison and how fast of cost of living is cost of living rising. I'm just trying to see where the reference point is on that how fast is cost of living rising on that 11 to 14 increases. Where's the point A to point B? Because I just see two.
Yes, so I did not pull out a reference point. I was just noting that in those counties, the cost of living was rising at different levels.
Okay, got it.
Sorry for the confusion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Actually, it's something from Representative Bentz. It kind of plays into, I think, the topic of preemption. And he was saying that, oh, geez, let me get my glasses off. He said that businesses are already leaving Malheur County for Idaho, and Malheur County is tied for the poorest county in Oregon, and that Oregon workers will be hurt because an increase in the minimum wage will move their $9.25 per hour job to Idaho, where they will make $7.25 an hour. And this is real, not some made-up situation. Jobs will be and now are being lost because of the talk of an increase, the talk of an increase. An $8 million investment, business investment, is not willing to commit to Malheur County because of this issue and the threat of the higher wage, all too real negative consequences to Oregon's most vulnerable. And so, I don't know, I guess if we did come up with a statewide, let's just say one of the ballot measures passed, then I would think that the people sitting here would be for allowing a preemption for municipalities to repeal it.
Well, the situation of Malheur County is it is a real challenge. I mean, being next to a state that has such a low minimum wage, you know, it's a challenge they face now. It's true. And, you know, it's not clear how we adjust to that. But, you know, I think that's that is a valid question. I want to ask Mike, this approach that Caitlin is suggesting of having us look at minimum wage zones more regionally as opposed to city by city, is that going to help with the problem that you've identified of, you know, where cities can have such arbitrary boundaries, and, you know, you have, you know, just because a store is located in Springfield and another one across the street in Eugene, but rather to look at it more in terms of, you know, a regional basis, however we set that region. Does that make sense?
Senator Denver, I think that's a really good question. And in terms of preemption, when you're talking about cities, they are localized. If you're talking about counties, not so much so. So, I mean, it seems to me that if you lift preemption, then you're lifting it statewide. So then you start talking one county having a higher minimum wage than the next county, just as Malheur County is going to be a higher minimum wage than Idaho. So I don't know that it would completely address the problem. From my point of view, it would be better because you're getting an entire area of the state that's going to have a similar wage. And if that area can support it, then it makes more sense. I just think the numbers are too high, but I'm no expert on any of that. I mean, it's the only reason we've raised minimum wages or raised prices since 2006 is every January 1st to account for the minimum wage increase. That's how much it impacts us. And so those are quarter, 50 cents, 35 cents, and we're having to raise prices somewhere under a dollar. You start talking about raising a dollar at a time, and we're going to, it's, and we don't have that much money. We just don't. I don't have a $1.25 million in extra money to throw at $15 minimum wage. I just don't have it.
How about the argument that that we heard somebody make that with a higher wage, people will have more disposable income? You know, they won't be going into debt every day, that they'll actually be able to go out and eat. Won't that help you?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I think that goes back to this argument, which I can't find a good answer to, as to what the minimum wage increase is going to do to the cost of living in the area. Because if you're seeing an inflation go up, if we're raising our prices 12% and other businesses across the city or the region or the state are having to do the same thing, then how much that's going to cause some degree of inflation. And so if you have that inflation, how much of the minimum wage increase are the employees really going to get if the inflation is there? And you're going to find some people that say, oh, doesn't cause any inflation. Intuitively, I know it's going to. So where's the balance there? Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it's, and economists have definitely put their head up against the wall repeatedly over that question. But there, you know, I think there have been a lot of analyses about it, but I'm not sure that they've really reached consensus. I don't know. Caitlin, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think that the two topics that economists have spent more time studying than any others in relation to the minimum wage are the questions of whether or not jobs will be lost or prices will go up, and that the economic community is fairly evenly divided on those issues, but that the current consensus is that prices go up, but at a much, much lower rate than the increase in the minimum wage. So you might expect a 1% or 2% increase in prices in some instances, and it depends on the industry.
Yeah, Mike.
Just one point on that, because I think sometimes we focus on the employees and the effect on the community, but we have a lot of senior citizens who aren't going to get that same increase in their pay. They just aren't. It's federally controlled. So you have senior citizens on Social Security. If they're living in a community where you've got a $15 minimum wage, even if the increase in cost of living is less than what the workers are gaining, you've still got those people that are retired, either on a pension or a fixed income of some kind, and they aren't going to see that same raise. So it's going to hurt them proportionally a lot more than would anybody else.
It's definitely something we have to take into account, I think, you know, and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we have to look at is presumably, you know, there will be savings to the state if we're not having to provide services to, you know, as many people. How do we use those savings? How do we use potentially the higher tax revenues that come in? And, you know, if we see a problem with people on fixed incomes, I do think we have to look hard at that. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay, then I think we made it just in under the hour. Thank you very much, all three of you. I think we've heard a lot of thought-provoking things today, and I really appreciate the tenor of the conversation. Got a lot of little raucous at one point, but thank you for your patience with that. So with that, colleagues, let me just say that we are planning to have a public hearing on this subject when we come back in January. The hope is that we'll have a proposal to share with you at that time, and we'll want to have a public hearing on that. So that'll be during January legislative days. So with that, colleagues, we are adjourned. With that, colleagues, we are adjourned.